Hello and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack
and Sean Chapman.
We are here to talk about stuff this week on the show. We're having a grab bag week.
Yep.
We missed last week because of a bunch of things.
Yes, busy week.
Busy week. I felt sick again. We were planning on something. I hadn't watched the thing for the something.
Neither did I.
And I couldn't fit it in, and so we didn't do it. And then this week we didn't fit it in either, but we had enough other stuff to talk about.
Yeah, there's more than enough stuff to talk about on this podcast.
So what stuff are we talking about this week, Sean? We're going to talk about the movie Annihilation.
Yep.
Which we both saw. We didn't, like, coordinate this.
No, like, I didn't even really plan on seeing it, and then, like, kind of, like, on that really busy weekend I had on that Sunday, I was just like, fuck it, I need to get out of the house, and so my dad and I went and saw Annihilation, and I liked it.
You liked it? Yeah. I liked it with reservations. I wound up seeing it twice, kind of by accident, I'll tell you. Not by accident, but just I saw it, and then my brother was like, oh, I wanted to see that, and I'm like, okay, and I went with him to see it again. And I'm glad we get to talk about it a little bit.
Yeah, it's a movie that's really interesting. Like, I think yes. It definitely has flaws, but there are things about it that are incredibly impressive.
Yes, so we should talk about it. We're going to talk about some news, including this week's Nintendo Direct, because as I usually do, I watched it and I took notes, and I basically, for the Nintendo stuff, I do what Sean does for everything else at E3.
Yeah.
Where you take exhaustive notes about it. I do that for all the Nintendo stuff, so we're doing that for... I make up for you killing yourself 1 week out of the year by doing it every couple months with Nintendo.
I mean, it makes more sense for the person who owns the Nintendo consoles to do the Nintendo dues, in my opinion.
It does. But yes, so we're going to go over that. Because today when we're recording this is March 10th, which Nintendo has dubbed Mario Day in their effort to have their own May the 4th.
Yeah.
We're going to do a random Mario topic. We're in a sequel... spiritual successor to last week's episode where we on-the-fly ranked Marvel movies. I'm going to try to on-the-fly rank Mario games, and it's going to be a train wreck, and it's going to be... We're doing it primarily for comedy.
Yes. This is the... Unlike the Marvel one, I'm not really involved in this process, because you have played a lot more Mario than I have.
Yes. So,
I'll chime in on, like, Mario 1, 3, World, and 64, which I think are all the Mario... And Sunshine. Yeah. Those are all the Mario games I've played.
Yes. So we'll look at those, and then we'll talk about Annihilation in spoiler detail. We're going to have a mini-topic on... the growing discussion from the year 1999 about video game violence.
Yeah.
And the White House, which just, I have thoughts on.
You know, if they brought Doom back, we have to bring the conversation around Doom back.
I guess so. I guess so. So, Sean, you want to get started with some stuff?
Yes.
What's been going on in your life? Anything to share?
Like, mostly just a lot of personal, like, me being incredibly busy with stuff. But there is one, like, video game stuff to talk about on this podcast. I, got the game Into the Breach, which is not sequel, but is the next game by Subset Games, the studio that made FTL, Faster Than Light. Did you ever play FTL?
No, I have. It's one of the many games I've gotten on a Steam sale and never
right.
played.
Yeah, FTL is... a really great roguelike from probably like 2012 or 2013. It's from a while ago.
Yeah.
That originally was just on PC. Now that game is on fucking everything. You know, you can probably play it on your phone. You can definitely play it on tablets. And FTL is like kind of, I think, secretly the best Star Trek game there's ever been. Like, it's all about you being on this spaceship and doing these sort of procedurally generated runs of you trying to get to the end of this like sort of like series of planetary systems. I think like fight a big pirate, or I forget what like the ultimate goal is. I only ever beat the game once because it is incredibly hard, but it was just about like having these wacky adventures of running into pirates and like alien bugs and shit in space. And it was a very sort of lo-fi game in terms of its style, because it's a like an indie game. It's a small team that makes it, and I loved FTL. So when I heard that Into the Breach, that team and studio came back with another new game, I immediately just jumped at it, and it is fucking awesome. And I think you would really like this game, Jonathan. Right now, it's only on PC, but I'm pretty sure it'll be coming to Mac sometime this year. And Into the Breach is basically, it has that kind of like roguelike, you know, run-based structure of you start the game with kind of like nothing other than a little bit of like bits and bobs you've earned by doing different achievements. And you try to sort of like get as far as you can and be as successful as you can, and then eventually... you will either win, which is very hard to do, or you will, like, fall apart and die, and you kind of, like, get a little bit of stuff that you achieved over that run to help you in the next one. So it's that basic structure. But instead of it being this sort of, like, turn-based ship combat thing in FTL, which was pretty light, like, there wasn't a lot of depth there. It was more about just, how, like, seeing what all the different, like, triggers could happen in this sort of, like, the randomness that you could run into in a run. Into the Breach is a turn-based, like, tactic strategy game that is centered around you control a team of three mechs and are fighting against these invading alien bugs that are trying to basically destroy buildings and like destroy like civilization and defeat you. And so the way that the game works is instead of it just being like Fire Emblem or Advance Wars or other kind of like turn-based strategy games, it's more, instead of you trying to just like destroy all the enemies and that is the victory condition is to survive for a certain number of turns. And it's like you spawn in with your three mechs and it's like you have to survive and protect the city for like, usually it's like about 10 turns or so, and about two or three enemies will keep on spawning in every single turn. And so at least with the original set of three mechs you get, because you can unlock different sets of mechs as you complete different achievements and get farther into the game, but the core set of mechs is like how I kind of started getting better at the game and realized, okay, this is what this game is about, was that like it's not about destroying the enemies, it's about managing the enemies. And killing the enemies is a good way to start managing them, because if you don't kill them, like more and more will keep on appearing. But it's way more about using your different movesets so you can push enemies along different tiles. So like one of the key mechs that you have in the first group is this mortar mech that fires a mortar shell along basically like any like line, like sort of like, oh, like all the way across the board, in front of it, behind it, to the right or to the left, because you know it's like a square grid. And if it where it launches the mortar shell, it creates an explosion that does one damage to whatever it hits, but then every adjacent square around that square, anything in those adjacent squares is pushed back one square away from that center point, which means you can shove enemies into the line of fire of another enemy, and so make the enemies fight each other. You can knock them out, and so they're not like attacking a building on the next turn, they're attacking empty space. There's all kinds of like crazy nonsense you can do. That it's a really deep, complicated strategy game, and it is...
This sounds great.
Yeah, it's fucking awesome. And it solves the main issue that I had with FTL, which was in FTL, it felt like whether or not you were successful was entirely... Well, not entirely, but like predominantly to the whims of the procedural systems and what you ran into of like, oh, like I was very lucky and kind of got these weapons early on because it just kind of worked out that way. And that made us like, I had a really great ion cannon and I got enough power to power up my shields. And that's how I ultimately won this run. It was not because like I was way smarter and better than everything else. And Into the Breach, there are definitely elements and factors of that, you know, you can get pretty lucky and end up getting a random drop in a map that will get you a weapon that's, like, really good. Like, that can happen and will help you out, but it is way more skill-based. It is way more about you being able to sort of adapt to whatever else is going on, and it always feels like at the beginning of each match, you have exactly what you need to be able to solve this battle perfectly. Like, it can happen, even no matter how stacked against you the deck may be. You can win this fight if you know what you're doing. And so it doesn't have that problem of me getting really frustrated at FTL because I felt like I was losing and it wasn't my fault. And Into the Breach, every time I lose, I kind of learn something by it of like, oh, fuck. Like, I should have probably... Because I'm doing stuff now of, like, using that mortar to attack one of my own units to blow enemies away from him. That's like, well, I will do this one bit of damage against my guy, but he will ultimately survive because he was going to be dealt, like, 5 damage by all the enemies that are now missing him because I did that. It's a lot of stuff like that. And then I haven't even really scratched the surface of the other mech teams you can unlock, of which there are, like, 8 or so. So, yeah, Into the Breach is really awesome. I think it is a game that people should have on their radar. It is definitely going to be up in, like, Game of the Year discussions at the end, and I've only put, like, 3 hours into it, and there's a lot more to dig into.
Well, speaking of Game of the Year discussions, I have a couple of Nintendo Switch things to talk about, but I'm going to go with this first, because I think it transitions well out of what you're talking about. I have finally started playing the Nintendo, it's on everything, but I'm playing on Nintendo Switch, indie game Celeste.
Yeah, I've heard about this.
Came out in January. It is an indie platformer by the same little team that made Towerfall Ascension several years ago, which is a great multiplayer game that I frankly never got fully into, even though I respected it more than I really enjoyed it. Celeste is easily, without any competition, the best game I have played so far in 2018. And looking at the calendar ahead, I really don't know what coming out this year would beat it for me. Other than, I mean, there will be surprises, so who knows? Yeah. But like, other than maybe Smash Bros, which we know is now coming, I think Celeste is a genre-shattering masterpiece. I have played half of it, exactly, because there's 8 levels. I've played 4. And the 4th level hit me so goddamn hard. It's been 2 days since I've played it, because I've had to feel like, I've been very busy, and I haven't been able to just go play like 30 minutes of it. I know I need to like wait for a time when I just have time blocked off, and I can sit and just sit with this game for a while.
Right.
Because the end of the fourth level, outside of all the platforming mechanics, which is the true brilliance of the game, and I'll get to it, or like the deepest brilliance of the game, has a piece where the story, character stuff, and the gameplay mechanics converge in a moment that is one of the most literally breathtaking, literally and figuratively breathtaking things I've ever seen in a video game. And I think Celeste is the best and most revolutionary and innovative indie game since the banner year of 2013, when we had like Gone Home and Stanley Paradox, right, and Papers, Please and all those, you know. Yeah. Hotline Miami was that year, or whatever year it was. I put it on my top 10 the wrong year, I remember.
Yeah.
So, you know, whenever that. But like that era, we've had a lot of good indie games since. This feels like it belongs in that like uppermost tier. And Celeste is primarily a platformer. It's a 2D platformer where the main character, Madeline, has gone to climb Celeste Mountain. At the beginning, you don't know exactly why, what her motivations are. It's kind of revealed over the course of things. It's a little bit like the game version of the movie/book Wild about Cheryl Strayed and her journey on the Pacific Crest Trail, where she's a woman who sort of has something to prove internally, and she does it through this big external physical show of determination and you know, stick-to-itiveness, those sorts of right. things. And in this case, Madeline has chosen to climb the mountain. This game is much less rooted in reality than something like Wild, because this is a sort of made-up video game mountain, and you have special video game powers. But it's amazing, because it's one of those platformers that, you know, I'm going to talk about Mario a little bit later.
Yeah.
This feels like one of the most just groundbreaking games outside of the basic Mario formula I've ever seen in this genre. And it has a lot of influences from especially recent 3D Mario games, which is interesting because you haven't seen a lot of games play with more recent mechanics that Nintendo's been doing in that area. In part because very few people make platformers.
Yeah.
And when they do, very few people make them particularly well, I think. It's kind of a lost art in some ways. Like that, you know, Sonic Mania last year being such a revelation, right?
Right.
Same kind of thing here, but it's one of those tenets of like that Mario-esque game design or Sonic-esque is to have a very simple set of powers, right? So in Celeste, you have a jump, you have a wall jump, and you have a dash where in midair you can move left or right, well, in any direction actually, very fast and get to higher heights. But you can only do that once per jump, unless there's a certain item in the level or certain conditions are met. And that basic control scheme is amazing and is so well built. But where the game really gets brilliant is in the level design, where it's a series of screens. If you die, you go immediately back to the beginning screen. It's got the same speed as like a Hotline Miami, where when you die, it doesn't really feel frustrating because you are right back in it. There's no time. There's no downtime to be like, oh, fuck, I have to do this again. There's just, let me do this again. This is great. And it's also, it's so gripping. It's so fair. Like, halfway through the game, I have not encountered a situation where I'm banging my head against a wall, angry at it. And I've done, like, because it counts at the end of each level how many deaths you have. I had over 400 in level 4.
Jesus.
Like, it's a ton, and I never, ever feel the weight of that while playing this game. It's just like, because you're experimenting it. Like, it really encourages you, like, your first time on a screen, you're never going to get through it right away. But you don't care, because what you're doing is like feeling things out and being like, okay, what's the height I need to get here? What's the angle? These rooms are so interestingly made. The graphics are gorgeous pixel art, which helps a lot too. But I just think the basic like design engineering of each level, each screen in this game is an absolute work of video game art in terms of how it taxes your brain. I think it exercises the same parts of your brain as a puzzle game, but with the feeling of a platformer. And some platformers have obviously done that, some more, some less, but I've never felt it so integrated as I do in Celeste. One of the smart things Celeste does as well is, in addition to having challenging, varied level design, like the four levels I've played, none are quite the same, and they're all amazing, and if you just run through them, they're really, really fun and interesting and challenging. But also, each screen has some secret to collect, whether the main collectible is strawberries, there's a cassette tape to get for each level that unlocks a piece of the soundtrack, there's all these sorts of little things. And the option of going and finding those in each level just adds this little extra challenge, and they're so fun. But I also like that they're not essential. So, like, sometimes I'll see a strawberry, I'll try it for a little bit, and then I'll be like, I really don't know, but it's not going to stop me. I can always come back and get this strawberry, because it keeps very clear records for you of what you do and don't have. And so it kind of frees you to say, take on as much challenge as you want, but then continue moving. So it's just, it is an expertly designed game. I think it's one of the very best pieces of video game design I've seen in years, and we're in a really good period for video games, so that's saying something. Like, I think this is a better platformer in terms of how it uses platform level design than Mario Odyssey from last year.
Jeez.
It is masterful. And when I say it takes stuff from Mario, like, I think it's level 2 where, like, Madeline starts seeing this, like, evil manifestation of herself and her psyche who is chasing her around, which very much feels borrowed from the Mario Galaxy levels where an evil Mario will chase you and you have to do everything while, like, there's a mirror version of yourself chasing you, but now it does it in 2D rather than the 3D Mario games. So, like, where it takes these kind of things that I think recent, like, Mario-esque platformers have done and, like does them in this really interesting, different 2D context. All of that is fascinating, but it really feels like a significant, like, step forward for that genre, especially for, like, an indie-made game. But I also think it being an indie-made game where basically one guy, as I understand it, did the level design.
Right.
There really is a clarity of vision and an authorial focus to how the levels are built. And it's amazing. And if it were just for the game design, this would be the best game I've played this year. It is so stunning, as I've said. It's so fun. There's so much just momentum to it because, like, the first level is pretty short, the tutorial level, but levels 2, 3, and 4 each have taken me about an hour to get through, and they both feel longer and shorter than that. I just get so lost in playing it. The music, oh my god, it's some of the best video game music I've heard in forever. It's so great. You should totally just listen to the soundtrack if you don't play the game. It's just this great atmospheric music. The game just is like this warm but challenging blanket that envelops you. But then on top of that, there is a story to the game, and it is amazingly written and presented, and what it does with player input in the story is so interesting, and how it kind of doles out Madeline as initially kind of a blank protagonist into someone with a really interesting story and struggle going on within her, and I am so fascinated to see where it goes. It is a pretty overwhelming emotional experience. And, you know, oftentimes in indie games, I feel like you get one or the other these days. You get brilliant, brilliant gameplay,
right,
but no real narrative content to speak of, which isn't a problem. I don't care. You don't necessarily need that. Or you get brilliant, brilliant storytelling with very little in the way of traditional gameplay to speak of. You know, I think something like Gone Home does have gameplay and it uses it very effectively and intelligently. It's just not what we would think of as intensive designed gameplay, you know?
Or like Into the Breach is a game that has like incredible game design, but like it has little bits of flavor text here and there in terms of the setting, but it doesn't really have a narrative because it needs to be this like thing that you play over and over and over again.
Exactly. And Celeste is at this perfect union where it takes those two things and it is as good a narrative as some of these great narrative indie games, and it is as well designed as some of these things like an FTL or an Into the Breach or something like that. And if you have a way to play Celeste, which you probably do because it's on PS4 and Xbox and Switch and PC, you should play Celeste. You just, it's a masterpiece. I love this game to death. And
awesome.
It's not like anyone's been sleeping on it. Critics all gave it like 10s out of 10s and stuff, which are usually reserved for like Zelda games or something. But play it if you haven't. Like, take it seriously. $20, it's worth it. So, yes.
Nice.
I got that with Nintendo has introduced a new thing for their rewards program.
Right.
Where with your gold points, because for the first year of the Switch, the My Nintendo rewards program was still around, and you have silver and gold points, but you could only redeem things for the 3DS or Wii U. 3DS, you know, still an active console.
Sure, yeah.
Wii U, it made no goddamn sense for. Like, one of the things you could redeem, you've been able to redeem all this time with your gold points, was the Mario Kart 8 DLC packs for Wii U, which is so silly because those are now, like, Mario Kart 8 Deluxe is out for Switch.
Right.
And I think has already sold more than the Wii U version, and those are just in there. So, like, who is still having their Wii U and being like, oh, I got these points. I can finally get that DLC for Mario Kart 8.
Great.
Yeah, I can play online with nobody else. Yeah, I don't know where that was coming from, but they finally implemented it for Switch. I think their problem was they didn't have anything free to give away for Switch yet.
Right. Because,
you know, a console in its first year, what games are you going to give away? They're not going to start giving away Breath of the Wild or something.
Right.
But what they've done, and I think this is very smart, is you can exchange your gold points for money on the eShop. And
nice.
You get your gold points by spending. So every $10 you get on the eShop, I think it is, you get 100 gold points.
So you're telling me that you literally have to spend money to make money.
Yeah, but it's a reward. Like, you get money back. It's a right. money back thing. If you spend money on the eShop or for physical games, because physical games will give you gold points as well. You just have to redeem it, especially like go to a menu for it. And with every 100 gold points, that's a dollar on the eShop. I had saved up 800 gold points over the years, so I got Celeste for $12, you know? Nice. So I got my $800 off. And I've bought a couple of other little things already, and, you know, those add up, and I've already got another $3 I can spend. So, like, it's very nice. It's not a ton of money, but, like, I prefer that. Like, that's a nicer program than you get for, like, buying stuff on the PlayStation Store or Xbox.
Right.
Both of those have sales tax. Nintendo doesn't, which is great. I mean, one day it'll probably happen, but for now, they haven't been hit by the sales tax genie. And, two, it's just, it's like a nice little money-back thing where, you know, you if you own a Nintendo Switch, you're gonna buy stuff from the eShop. Like, that'd be very weird if you just, for some reason, refused to buy anything from the eShop.
Yeah, and refused to redeem your
points. Right.
Yeah.
So you get some points, you get some free money, you know, it's a good little deal all around. It's good for them, it's good for us. I like it. Cool. It is. It feels like one of those things where it's like, huh, Nintendo knows what they're doing on an online thing. Not on all the online things.
Yeah, no.
Not on most of the online things, but this little thing, they got that going on. That's good. Yeah. Nice. And I've played two other things on the Nintendo Switch I should mention really quick. One, I did finish Dragon Quest Builders, and that's why I have the time now to play Celeste.
Right.
Dragon Quest Builders is great. I think it's probably a little too long in the tooth near the end.
Sure.
It is also a JRPG, so yeah, that happens.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it's one of those.
I think it's just, though, this is one of my favorite JRPGs ever. It is so creative. It is such a genre buster in terms of how it mixes, you know, very traditional Dragon Quest JRPG sort of stuff with Minecraft, which really hasn't become a full genre yet, even though it kind of should be, I feel like.
Yeah, or it's like, it became a full genre of, like, really shitty Minecraft ripoffs on, like, the iPhone store,
yes.
You know?
It became a genre of clones.
Exactly.
And this is really building off that foundation, no pun intended. And it's just, it really is, I think it gets a little long, but it's great throughout. The writing is so good, the music is so good, the visuals are so great. It's such a creative way to play a game like this. It is consistently evolving. The Nintendo Switch is the perfect platform for it, because I played that game probably equally across handheld and on in the TV, because it was so easy to pick up and play and everything, so I really enjoy that game. I recommend it. Whatever platform you have that can play it, you should play it.
Right.
And I think it's on Vita. I don't know. That feels like it's probably
I'm pretty sure it came out on Vita.
It did. I don't know if that's the best version of the game, but it is out there. So, you know, get it. Get Dragon Quest Builders. It's fun. And there will be a sequel eventually, and it looks good too.
Yeah,
so.
I think I'm probably going to end up just waiting for two, because I have a lot of games to play.
I totally understand, and that probably is a smart thing to do, although if you ever, like, suddenly go into a time warp and have the time, I would pick up Dragon Quest Builders 1, because it is special. And on Switch, it has that sweet-ass box art.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's still a cool thing. I also, in Jonathan's beta beanbag,
I don't know what's happening now. What is this?
I can't have my own beta corner, of course,
because
you have that corner is saved for you.
Exactly.
So this is my beanbag in the center of the room, I guess.
Yeah, I let you come in sometimes and hang out in the beta corner.
This isn't really a beta. They called it a demo.
Okay.
But I did play the demo for Kirby Star Allies.
Can we call this Jonathan Lack's Demo Den?
Let's do it. Den. It's Jonathan's Demo Den. Jonathan and his friends.
Okay, that's
in
too much.
The Demo Den.
This has gone on too long already.
I'm sorry. I played the demo for Kirby Star Allies on the Nintendo Switch, which, annoyingly, it came out in the European eShop and then took like 5 days to come out in the North American eShop. So I just made a European account.
Sure.
Now,
yeah.
I did something. It's very easy to make. Like, there's no hassle to making a European account. But the country I chose, and I don't really know why I did this, was France.
Monsieur Lac?
Yes. I guess I forgot that there are plenty of European countries where the default language is English.
Yeah, you know? Like some would say most of them.
Yes, but I picked one with a language I do not understand, and I actually have a harder time navigating the French eShop than I do the Japanese one, because frankly I know more Japanese.
Yeah, right?
I can't read it all, but I also, most of it's in like katakana, and those are just English words, like transliterated, so it's like, yes, Renkingu. Okay.
I can figure that one out.
Right. But anyway, I figured it out. I got my demo down. It's completely in English, so, you know, wherever you get it from, it's fine. And I think a lot of people I've seen have been a little disappointed in the demo for Kirby Star Allies. I liked it a lot, but I also think I understand the source of the disappointment. And some of it, I think, is just... I think Kirby is hitting a bigger audience right now than it has in the past.
Sure, yeah.
And Kirby is a very different platformer series for Nintendo. It is just... It's one of the most unique platform series out there. You know, like, a Sonic the Hedgehog is a very unique platformer series, but it is also based on speed and momentum and, like, really draws you in. Kirby is not that. It's not really built to be challenging. It's not really built to be fast. It has a very different kind of low-key charm to it. And I think Star Allies, from what I've seen, does that very well. I also think that charm is exceptionally difficult to demo, like, pull out one level from and say, you're going to get it out of this. But having played some Kirby games in the past, like Planet Robobot a couple years ago was in my top 10, I liked this. I don't think it's, from what I've seen so far, as good as like a Planet Robobot, although I also don't know, because Planet Robobot in one level does not reveal its greatness.
Right.
But it seemed creative. It's a very much a co-op game, whether you're playing it alone or with friends. Kirby has allies with him. The Star Allies thing is Kirby has these items he can throw that are stars that make other people into his friends on screen. And that's a cool little mechanic.
Wait, so there are people already there, and then you throw stars at them and they become your friend?
Yeah. That's... Well, they're bad guys. You make the bad guys your friends.
Through the power of
love.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know.
Let's not interrogate that premise too much.
But it means you have a lot more powers to deal with. It's kind of interesting. There's a lot of little interesting challenges with them. I do think the game is even better with two or more players. I did do one level co-op with my brother, and that was the most fun I had with it. But it's still interesting whether or not how you play it. It looks gorgeous. Very, like, well-designed in terms of art game. Very colorful. Got great music. It seems like very much a good, solid Kirby game, and maybe more than that. Because, like, what I've seen of the trailers of stuff outside of these two levels look even more interesting. And I just, you know, Kirby has not had a big console spotlight in a while.
Yeah.
And so I'm excited to see that here. And, you know, it comes out next Friday. I'm excited to play the shit out of it. And I'll try to finish Celeste by then, you know?
Right.
So, yeah, but I'm excited for this game.
Like, how much of the slightly more tepid reaction do you think is just because... I don't... This might just be, like, my impression of it, and because I haven't looked it up, of, like, the release dates. But it feels like Kirby games are coming out more often than they used to. It used to feel like a Kirby games just, like, sort of came out near the end of a Nintendo console. And it was like, the console was kind of going away, and it's like, now we're going to start putting out some Kirby games. And now it feels like there's been, like, a Kirby game a year for a while.
I think it's a couple different things. I think they have increased because I think the Kirby team hit a certain stride in the 3DS years and a certain format that I think caught on with more people. But I don't think it ever really fell off. I think it's half that I do think there probably is a little more than usual coming out for Kirby. I also think that Nintendo is leaning on Kirby as one of their top-tier franchises heavier than they have in the past.
Sure,
like,
yeah.
There were major Kirby games on the Wii. The GameCube didn't. The GameCube only had the Air Ride one, which is more of a spin-off sort of thing. But I think with the Wii, they got back into it where they would have at least one main platformer per console, but it didn't have kind of... They didn't treat it like they treat a Mario or something. Part right. of it with Star Allies is that, you know, the Switch had this incredibly successful first year with their two biggest properties, Mario and Zelda, and next up to bat is Kirby. And I think in part just because of the stature of the Switch right now, this is their big release for this time of the year so far in terms of a non-port original new title. And so, yeah, this is the most spotlight a Kirby game has had on it since the Nintendo 64. Like, I don't know. It's been right. a while since... Because even on the 3DS, it felt like it wasn't being asked to sort of carry a month the way Star Allies is. And so I think some of it is people are just going to have to kind of come in fresh and understand what kind of game this is. I also think part of it is, you know, Breath of the Wild and Super Mario Odyssey are tough acts to follow.
Sure,
and Star Allies is in the unenviable position of having to do that. And it probably won't be as good as those games, which is fine.
Well, and I mean, it seems like it's not going in with this, like, tremendous ambition of changing what you understand Kirby to be. It sounds like it's a game where you play as Kirby and you suck people up and take their powers, and then you, like, brainwash people to be your friends.
It feels like a modest console-based evolution of what they've been doing on the 3DS, which is no small thing, because the 3DS games were great. And this seems great in its own way. But yeah, I am curious what the overall, like, critical reaction and everything is going to be. Because also, like, this is a Kirby game that's going to have big day one review coverage. Right. That has not happened in a while. I can tell you. Planet Robobot did not have day and date reviews on every major review site. You know, I heard about it through the grapevine and bought it a month after it came out. Like, that's kind of Kirby's sweet spot, I feel like.
Right, yeah.
And I don't know if Kirby is meant to be under the spotlight this way. Even though I actually think more people should play it because, as we learned this week, or relearned, we all knew this, Smash Bros. drives everyone fucking crazy because they all love it.
Yeah.
And so many of the Smash Bros. Aesthetics and conventions come from Kirby games because it's all HAL Laboratories, and Masahiro Sakurai is the creator of Kirby, you know? So, like, if you like Smash Bros., you should give Kirby a chance just to see where a lot of that comes from. Because it's an interesting blend of things. Even though it feels kind of crazy that the same guy is responsible for the utter madness of Smash Bros. And the quaint madness of Kirby.
Right.
But we all have those sides to us.
But there's the floatiness in the jump is distinctly similar.
Yes, absolutely. So anyway, this has been Jonathan's Demo Den.
What a journey has been.
Yes.
Jonathan's Demo Den.
You want to see some news? Do some news?
What's happening in the news, Jonathan?
You want to do some quick Oscars reactions? The Oscars were last Sunday.
Yes, they were.
I did not see the whole show. I was able to watch the last hour live. I came in right after Jordan Peele won his Oscar, which was awesome.
Yeah.
And before that, I was having to follow it on Twitter while at work. But I was able to follow the awards on Twitter, and then I got home and saw the last couple of awards handed out. And so I can't really speak to the quality of the ceremony. It seemed very up and down in the way Oscar ceremonies usually are.
Right.
Although we had a lot of good winners, which meant a lot of good speeches. Speaking as just someone analyzing the awards themselves, I liked how the awards shaped out this year. Because I think 2017 was a really, really uniquely rich year for film. And they recognized that by generally spreading the wealth. They did it in the nominations. They did it in the awards. No one film was, like, super dominant. Even The Shape of Water only won 4 Oscars. Which has been true a lot lately, that one film, like, doesn't win a ton. But then, like, I don't know, it doesn't go to as many corners, or it goes to corners that are much less deserving and less interesting. I feel like everything that won major awards was an interesting project, or the one big movie up for Oscars this year I didn't like, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, which is horrible. The two people who won, Sam Rockwell and Frances McDormand, I would have preferred other performances for other films win, but also, like, who's going to knock Sam Rockwell and Frances McDormand?
Right.
They're awesome. They, particularly Frances McDormand, gave amazing speeches. Frances' speech was one of the best things I've ever seen at the Oscars. I think it's the most powerful thing I've seen at the Oscars since the performance by Common and John Legend of the Selma song, Glory. Just a great moment where she had all the women nominated stand up. She did the thing about inclusion writers. Really, really great moment. And, you know, so I'm not angry about that. even though, you know, Lady Bird, the best film of last year, was completely shut out, which is stupid. It should have won Best Supporting Actress for Laurie Metcalf, and it didn't. And that's, like, I feel like that would have been the easy place to award it. And I love Allison Janney, but you can't tell me her performance in I, Tonya is of the same level of substance as Laurie Metcalf in Lady Bird. You just can't. So, anyway. But
there was no Suicide Squad this year.
No Suicide... No. Nothing as bad as Suicide Squad won anything. Everything that won, at least in that category, had a very good reason to win. You know? And there were some genuinely just amazing ones. Like, Jordan Peele is an Oscar winner for original screenplay now.
Yeah.
That's fucking awesome.
And, like, a really well-deserved Oscar for that movie. Like, yes. For Get Out, like, I think, you know, I would say that Get Out could have won Best Picture, and I would not have,
totally,
like, been upset about that. I think it's, like, that's a fucking amazing movie. But particularly its screenplay is really remarkable. Like, that it comes through in the movie.
Yeah, if I had to pick one award for Get Out to win, it would probably be screenplay.
Yeah.
Because I think that's probably the biggest source of its brilliance. So that was totally deserved. Roger Deakins won an award for cinematography. Finally, this was his 14th fucking nomination and first win. And it was for Blade Runner 2049. I don't think for that particular award you can get much more deserving than that.
Yeah.
And that was a great category. All 5 of those, super deserving. And I really hope Rachel Morrison, who was up for Mudbound, gets another shot at it next year for Black Panther. Because I saw Black Panther again. And let me tell you what, that movie deserves a cinematography nod.
Sure,
you know,
yeah.
If Blade Runner can get it, Black Panther should fucking get it.
Yeah.
And a lot of other nominations as well. She's going places, I think. But anyway, you know, that was great. Shape of Water was not my favorite movie last year. It was not quite in my top 10. I still think it's a great movie. I really liked it. I admire the fucking hell out of it, and I admire what it has to say and how it says it. And Guillermo del Toro is just one of the best people on this planet.
Yeah.
And he deserves to have a Best Director Oscar. I think you could argue maybe, you know, in the future people will look back and be like, how did he not get that for Pan's Labyrinth or something? But it is, this is not a case where it's like, I don't know, Steven Spielberg not winning until Schindler's List or something. Right. Although Schindler's List is very good too. It doesn't feel like it's not his moment. Shape of Water is great. It is such a movie that is of him that I think it is deserving he wins Best Director. I love that in the same decade, him, Alfonso Cuarón, and Alejandro González Iñárritu,
yeah,
the three amigos, as they call themselves, the three amigos of Mexican cinema, all have won Oscars within the same decade. That's fucking awesome. Like, how cool is that moment just lined up for all of them?
Yeah.
And, you know, he gave a great speech. I think Shape of Water is a deserving picture winner. I really wish Emily Hawkins had won for actress. If I could have picked out of those five, I think it would have been her. But they're all great. You know, actor went to Gary Oldman, and I actually had not heard about the thing about the domestic abuse allegations against, yeah, Gary Oldman until Oscar night. So that's bad, obviously. But Gary Oldman is a great actor, and he was really great in Darkest Hour, and I feel like the people I've seen making fun of Darkest Hour definitely haven't actually seen the movie, because it does kind of look like Oscar the movie, but right, it is better than that. It is quite a good film, and you should see it if you can. It's an interesting movie. And it won for makeup, which is deserving, and yeah, just they really spread it around. I think like a lot of good movies won awards, and I like to see that, you know. Could they take even more strides towards inclusion in everything? Yes. I think the fact that Lady Bird got to the nomination phase and no one ever took it seriously in any of those awards like categories pisses me off, but I also know that it was an uphill battle for it to even get like a director nomination, given that Greta Gerwig is the fifth woman to ever do that,
right.
So like, that's disappointing, but you know, these barriers are broken one step at a time. It was a cool ceremony. A lot of good awards were given. That's kind of what matters to me. And you know, I would just ask the people like making fun of The Shape of Water as a safe choice.
Like, fucking, like, check yourself. Because it's like, it's a fight. Like it's what, something that has been driving me crazy about the conversation around The Shape of Water. I haven't even fucking watched the movie yet. But it's like, it's a genre movie.
Yeah.
It's not, like, it's not a fucking historical biopic. It's not some, like tense modern contemporary drama movie. It's a fucking, like, romance movie with a monster as one of the main characters.
Yes.
Like, one of the main characters of that movie is in full-body prosthetics and, like, costume for the whole fucking movie.
Looking like the creature from the Black Lagoon.
Yeah, like, that's insane. That's, like, unheard of. Like, that's fucking, like, movies that are outside of just, like, the fucking, like, uncategorizable genre of, like, drama never win fucking best picture. It's like Mad Max or something. Like,
yes.
It's in that box of like movie that is not normal, generic, contemporary, like Oscar type drama movie.
I think this is only the second movie that's ever won best picture that you would call fantasy, the other being Return of the King.
Yeah.
So yes, I mean, just on,
like, it's amazing to me. And yes, then like nobody's even noting that that's the case. It's,
yeah,
like it's a fucking like fantasy romance movie. That's crazy.
But I would ask you to think about that. I would also ask you to, whether you liked the movie or not. And again, I'm someone who really liked it, but I don't think had the ardent love that some people do, which just, movies speak to us in different ways, and that's the beautiful thing about them. But look at that film and think about what it's saying. Think about what it is saying about love in oppressive atmospheres. Think what it is saying about marginalized people who have literally had their voices taken from them, figuratively and literally. Think about what it is saying about female sex and sexuality and sexual pleasure. You know, think about, I think, how it reflects our current political moment. That movie, the waters of that film run so much deeper than I think a lot of snarky people on Twitter are giving it credit for. And yeah, is it as culturally daring a movie as Get Out? Not as in your face, no. But in a very different way, yes, it has a lot of things to say, and it says them very beautifully. And just think about that. Because if you're thinking like this is like Spotlight winning a couple of years ago over Mad Max, no, it's not. It's not. It contorts to zero like conceptions of what an Oscar movie is.
Yeah.
Other than it is pretty, you know, it looks nice. But I would say it looks much nicer than most Oscar winners, because tell me one significant composition from Spotlight or something, you know, like,
right.
It's not that kind of thing. So, yeah, just yeah. Keep that in mind. Keep your snark in check on that. Look, I like being snarky, but on this thing, like, watch the movie. It comes out on Blu-ray next week. Give it a look. It deserves it.
Yeah. And it's like, I just love that Del Toro got to win an Oscar, like, for a movie that's a him movie. That it's like, yes. He didn't have to go, like, make, you know, some, like, again, like, some sort of, like, historical biopic or something that is the more typical movie that would win an Oscar. Like, he got to make a movie that, like, has a monster as one of the main characters.
He's been trying to make this movie his whole fucking life. Yeah. Like, this is a passion project. I think there's also this weird knee-jerk reaction I don't like around Del Toro where people have started dismissing his English language work. And fuck you. Like, The Shape of Water has so much in common with his Spanish language work. Crimson Peak has so much in common with his Spanish language work. Those are not less pure expressions of who he is. Because also, he's an immigrant and lives in America and has the right to make his movies in English, and those still be a part of him.
And we all know that the purest expression of who Guillermo del Toro is Pacific Rim.
Yes, like that's the other thing.
That's his id on screen.
I love that the man who directed Pacific fucking Rim has a Best Director Oscar now.
Yeah.
Because you're right, Pacific Rim is just as much an auteur statement as The Shape of Water is. I think they are pretty much interchangeable in terms of just raw quality. But of course, Pacific Rim is never going to win an Oscar.
Yeah.
And Shape of Water weirdly had a chance. So,
but,
yes.
But maybe the fact that, you know, Shape of Water has broken down that fucking, like, genre door, and maybe, it like, who knows, I bet it'll just go back to the way it was next year. This is just, like, a weird year for movies. But, like, there's a world in which now there's, like, a bunch of people at the Academy who fucking vote for this shit are like, oh, right, like, we can like, vote for those movies. It's fine. Like, the movies that people actually like, the ones that, like, people watch and enjoy, those movies, those are the ones we can also vote for.
I mean, just think about how far we've come, because I think even in like, 5-10 years ago, Darkest Hour would have completely swept the competition.
Yeah, it's like, because, like, Darkest Hour looks like The King's Speech or something like that, right?
And it's a vastly better movie than The King's Speech. The King's Speech is a C at best. It's fine, but it looks like a TV movie, like, and not a particularly good one. And it won everything that fucking year over much, much better movies. And this year, like, Darkest Hour was kind of an afterthought and won two awards, and they were deserved, and that's fine. But, yeah, there were a lot of, like, the movies that people really responded to, Shape of Water, Get Out, Lady Bird, Three Billboards is a movie people responded to in very polarized ways, but they responded to it.
Yeah.
You know, these movies won big awards, that's cool. And I think that's what the Oscars are for at their best.
Yeah.
Call Me By Your Name also. I've forgotten to mention this. It won Best Screenplay for James Ivory, who at 89 is the oldest person to ever win a competitive Oscar. James Ivory is a titan in filmmaking with the Ivory Merchant films, you know, he made with his partner, James Merchant, I forget Merchant's name. Something. Maybe they're both James. I don't know. Anyway, he wrote Call Me By Your Name. Call Me By Your Name is a movie every fucking human being should see. It is absolutely amazing. It was kind of slept on throughout the Oscar season, I think, other than screenplay. But masterpiece. You should see that movie. So, yeah. Anyway.
Awesome.
If you need recommendations, I've got them for you. But Phantom Thread won Best Costume Design.
Sure,
which is that is the award that movie was born to win.
Yes, it's in the title.
It's right there. So anyway, I was happy. This is enough Oscar. This is probably the most cumulative Oscar talk we've ever done.
I think it's the most interesting Oscars I think I've ever seen. Like in my lifetime.
Yes, totally in my lifetime, because like there were just some special things. Like the director category was so stacked this year. And also, like, I think by the time award night came, people were leaning Shape of Water. But if you could honestly say, oh, I knew that was going to win, you're lying. It was very unpredictable to the last moment. You know, like, there was a real chance Three Billboards could have come in and, like, been the crash of 2018, and it wasn't. So,
yeah.
It was an interesting season. All right, let's do some other pieces of news quick. All right, Sean, PlayStation Plus announced that they are dropping the PS3, PS Vita games next year. I'm both surprised that it took them this long, I guess.
Right.
But I am also wondering, what does PS Plus become if it's just two usually shitty PS4 games every month?
Well, I think they have really stepped up the quality of the PS4 games in the past couple of months. Like, it has gotten a lot better. I mean, like Ratchet & Clank is one of the... Ratchet & Clank and Bloodborne are the two games this month.
And I have noticed that, and I've downloaded both of those, and I'm so glad I have them through PS Plus. But I just, I wonder if that's a blip or it's going to be part of a trend.
Yeah, because like, I hope that it's, because again, I think it's something that is, that's like, this is kind of the most remarkable month, I think, that PS4, PS Plus has had. But it's been a thing for the past few months of like getting like more like proper, pretty good video games coming out of that. But like, yeah, it's something of where I think everybody has the reaction. It's just like the most human reaction possible of that of like, no, you're taking this thing away from me. And then I stopped and thought of it as like, when is the last time? Like I have to like seriously wonder what is the number of people that have like booted up the PS3 or PS Vita, PS Plus games every month. Like it's got to be an infinitesimally small number, right?
Yes.
Because they have fucking run those wells dry. People don't make PS Vita games anymore other than Japan. Like, they kind of ran out of new ones. And obviously nobody's making PS3 games anymore. So it's like, it has to end eventually. Like, I hope that eventually there's an announcement that they'll do something to sort of increase the user end value of PS Plus. But it's something that, but like, I do not foresee myself having to have, like, incurred any meaningful loss by not having those titles.
But what I do think this does is it puts a foot in the door to start having the conversation again about, we've all just taken for granted, it is dumb consumer hostile practice to have a $60 a year price tag attached to your console to go on the fucking internet.
Right.
It is just hostile. And I think, especially at this point, it feels more so than ever. I don't like it. I don't like it especially when the things they've attached to it are generally so paltry. They've been paltry forever. Xbox has a slight leg up at the moment because they have the 360 backwards compatibility program. But also, like, that's all Xbox has these days.
Right.
Is the games you could play on your old fucking Xbox. So it's just kind of weird. You know, it's a lot. You have to pay the price of a full game to go online on these systems. And you don't have to do that on your PC.
Yeah.
You don't have to do that on your smartphone. You know, for a while you haven't had to do that on Nintendo systems. They're going to change that, but also not for $60 a year. And frankly, the games they're going to be giving away for the Nintendo Switch are probably games Nintendo fans are more interested in playing, because Nintendo fans like their old classic games.
Sure.
So, I don't know. I think the answer would be, I think the price on these things needs to come down. Also, just the internet. Like, PSN is a shitty fucking internet system. And, like, I've learned this, I've been in a new house. I literally, my PS4, I cannot get Wi-Fi where it is in my house.
Huh.
It is just, with whatever network I try, I cannot make it work. It is such a low connection. And it's always been, the PS4 gets much worse internet than any of my other devices. But it just literally can't get it where it is now. And it's not that far from my router. But there's a wall, and it's just fucked. And my Nintendo Switch is this little thing right next to it, and it's fine, and downloads fast. And so it's just things like, it's like, okay, PSN, and like the PSN store is slow and shitty, and their download speeds are slow and shitty. And those are not the things you pay for, I get that. But like, it does feel like if I'm paying $60 a year for these things, like what am I paying? What's that going to? Where are you putting the money? I don't get this thing. Like, you guys are selling plenty of these fucking systems and games and everything. What are you using it for? And kind of same with Xbox, which doesn't have as many, you know, problems with that. But I fundamentally don't get the purpose of these programs anymore. And we just take it so for granted. I think it's worth questioning.
Yeah, no, it's a weird situation because there is, like, because I feel like there's not enough visibility of knowing, like what is that money going to? Because there is, you know, like, they have to fucking, like, keep up servers for, like, all, like, your saves and all the information, like, the data on the games and all that shit. Like, there has got to be, like, they must incur significant costs having to manage and run those things. But there's no visibility on it, you know?
No,
it's all, like, behind this iron curtain.
But, like, compare this also to other, like, online systems we all pay for. Like, okay, I have extra iCloud storage on my iPhone because I just need... I do a lot with email and some files online, and I just needed a little extra. And I have, like, the 50-gigabyte plan, and I pay $1 a month. It's $12 a year. For OneDrive, you know, I have that as student pricing, so I forget what I paid for it 4 years ago. But it breaks out to a lot less than $60 a year, and I have a terabyte of OneDrive storage. Or pick whatever your poison is. These sorts of things in other contexts don't cost you $60 a year.
Yeah.
And I don't think PS Plus or Xbox Live are providing that much more of a service that it is necessarily justified. And that's just my two cents.
Yeah, like again, like I would be really deeply interested in finding out like how much are they making away on that shit? You know, is it like movie theater popcorn? You know, yeah. is it just that? Like, it's like, because I just don't know. Because no information on it at all.
I think it has to be like movie theater popcorn, because here's the thing. The infrastructure has to be there, whether the people are paying for it or not. Like, they have to have the servers up and running. They have to, like, just for downloading and uploading games and stuff like that, you have to have some of that stuff in there. And then everything else can run through some of those same pipes. Maybe I'm sounding completely ignorant here, but, like,
I don't know. Because that's one of the things of, like, I also just, I don't know how much, yeah. like, I have no idea, like, everything that has to go on to yeah. run a service like that. Because it's also, it's not just cloud saves, like, it's having to sort of, like, keep this account and have the account interact with all the other accounts and, like, maintain this sort of, like, play space online and all the data interaction that has to go with all the games that you can play on yeah. PS, online on PlayStation 4 or Xbox One. Yeah.
Although, again, like, you know, Apple does that too with their iCloud stuff. I pay that dollar a month because I need a little extra storage than the average person. Everyone who has an iPhone has an iCloud account
yeah.
and does all those same, maybe not with the same intensity, but you do have an account that tracks all of your stuff and keeps your thing consistent across devices, and you don't have to pay for that.
Yeah.
And on a lot of devices, that's just the case. So I don't know. It seems like it's something that is probably necessary. Otherwise, you know, Nintendo probably wouldn't be getting in on the fun with this.
Right.
But yeah. I also think there's maybe a reason why Nintendo isn't doing it at $60 a year. As from what we've heard, maybe they're going to change their mind. I have no idea. But right. all the reports we've heard are that it's not going to be that. And Nintendo's a leaky ship. So anyway, yeah. Just little thing to talk about, but worth thinking about. But yeah, hey, Bloodborne and Ratchet & Clank this month are awesome. Don't know when I'll have time to play them. I do want to give Bloodborne another shot one day.
Yeah.
And maybe if I get into Dark Souls when it comes out on Switch, Bloodborne would be a good next step.
That'd be a good place to go.
Yeah. yeah. All right. So anyway, Avengers.
Yes.
There's a new one coming out, Avengers Infinity War. Little thing, but I loved last week on Twitter, they just, in a thread with a random fan, who might have been a plant, I don't know, was like, I want to see Avengers when the rest of the world does here in the U.S. Because if you don't know, Marvel movies typically come out a week early, the rest of the world. And so Marvel's like, that's a great idea. We can make it happen. And then just dropped a poster where it says, Avengers Infinity War, now coming April 27th. That was a baller move. I've never seen that, where a movie was just like the big summer tentpole went, fuck it, we'll move up a week, like 2 months before the movie comes out. I think that's hilarious. I think clearly Disney has learned the lesson that when you release your movie doesn't fucking matter. Like the summer movie thing is, it doesn't even actually make sense as an idea, because most summer movies bomb over the last couple years, and the movies that break the records are in February or March or October or something, or November. But they're moving it to April, so we're going to get to see it a week early when the rest of the world does, so no fear of spoilers, which is also nice. And it's also smart for Disney, because it gives them more space for that Han Solo movie.
Right,
and Marvel's partner over at Fox for Deadpool, which I guess Fox is owned by Disney now, so actually it all makes sense.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it's a little thing. I just think the funny thing was doing it 2 months before release randomly on Twitter.
Yeah, it takes like some confidence as a studio to just do that. Just say, fuck it. Like, we'll just move this release date. Who gives a shit?
I think they were like, they looked at the box office for Black Panther and said, we can do whatever the hell. We are gods.
Yeah.
We can do literally anything. Fuck it. Move it a week up. Release it tomorrow. If the effects aren't finished, fuck it. They'll like it.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll still break a billion.
Yeah, no, it's I'm excited for this movie, Sean.
You too.
I also think, like, Black Panther is the best advertising this movie could possibly ask for.
Yeah, especially, like, when you, like, realize retroactively how much Black Panther and Wakanda are in the Avengers Infinity War trailer. And, like, they fucking knew what they were doing.
They knew what they were doing because everyone on Earth loves this fucking movie and wants more of it. And while it's going to take a couple years to make a Black Panther sequel, oh good, Avengers Infinity War has a lot of Black Panther in it and it's coming out now.
Because it's not just Black Panther, it's like Black Panther and the supporting characters from Black Panther that are all fucking awesome.
Yes, so I saw that movie a second time. It is so good. I love that. We were so right calling it the best Marvel movie, because it is. Anyway, all right. Call of Duty, they announced their new games. Well, okay, it leaked, and then they had to put out a press release.
It leaked, but it leaked in, like, a really sort of suspicious way that felt like now they're just leaking shit as their, like, secret way of announcing shit.
Yeah,
they're it's annoying.
Yeah, so their next game is Call of Duty Black Ops 4. That itself is not necessarily surprising. What is surprising is the title treatment is not Call of Duty Black Ops Roman numeral 4. It is not common Call of Duty Black Ops Arabic numeral 4.
Yeah.
It is Call of Duty Black Ops I, which is not a form of notation unless you're doing the scratch marks.
Yeah, it's like a tally mark thing or something.
So when you look at it, you just think it's Call of Duty Black Ops 3, and then you're like, wait, is there an optical illusion? Oh, there's actually four, but because my eyes aren't used to seeing four fucking lines indicating a four, I can't really tell what the title is. And it is the worst fucking title treatment I think I've ever seen for a video game.
Yeah. I am wondering if they change it. Like, it's just absurd. There's no fucking reason. It doesn't make your game seem like, oh, they're so bold and interesting by using this weird notation to indicate that it's the fourth Black Ops game. It's just like, what the fuck are you guys doing? Like, is there an idiot at their studio that doesn't understand, like, the common usage of Roman numerals? Like, this is really bizarre.
It's weird. I think it's weird that Call of Duty now has this one series that is consistently going on, and it's the Black Ops series. And I feel like every time it comes out, it's the Call of Duty that's least talked about, because it's just, you know, once you're at three or four, who cares?
Yeah.
But they are also, like, I think consistently the highest sellers of all the sub-series right now.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So it's a weird situation to be in, because also, like, Infinite Warfare isn't getting a sequel, sadly, because that game kind of bombed, even though it was the best Call of Duty game. So they're going to have to restart something over there. World War II, I have zero sense of how that game did.
I think it sold really well, like it, for that community, but I don't think, like, it didn't, like, have, like, a sort of, like, cultural impact is my impression of it.
So I would be, I don't know if they're going to do Call of Duty World War III or whatever their next one is.
World War II,
yes. I have no idea what the other, like, there are three very disparate Call of Duty sub-series going on, and sub-series within those sub-series, and then there's this one rock, which is Black Ops, which, I've only played Black Ops 1, and that feels like a lifetime ago, because I think that came out when I was in fucking high school.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, but now we're on Black Ops III.
Which is also when, like, technically it is the fifth game in the Black Ops lineage, because World at War is the, right, like, the first one that introduces the story thread.
Well, I guess, I mean, Treyarch knows what they're doing. They know what their cash cow is. They know how to butter that bread, but yeah.
Yeah, no, it's, the Call of Duty is feeling very exhausted. In the way that, like, the two, it's really frustrating to me, because the two Call of Duty games post-Modern Warfare that are by far the most interesting to me are the two that the community, like, absolutely just rejected and threw into the trash, Advanced Warfare and Infinite Warfare. Two games that I really adore. Advanced Warfare, because I think the multiplayer is fucking crazy and awesome. Infinite Warfare, because I think the campaign and single-player story is fucking crazy and awesome. It's like, the Call of Duty community just, like, ripped those games up and threw them in the trash, and it's like, no, we want the exact same fucking game we've been playing since Call of Duty 4.
And that's what,
want that again with, like, really bad wall running.
And that's what Black Ops is, right?
Cause, basically,
like, Black Ops is Modern Warfare in a more palatable, like, sustainable package.
Yeah, it's like, I think Black Ops 3 was the one that had, like, some weird, like, hero character stuff. So it had, like, it, like, went a little bit outside the sort of, like, the state tracks, but it still felt like it was a, like, Advanced Warfare went to this, like, extreme place, and then they reined it in with Black Ops 3 is what it always felt like to me.
So. Yeah. Well, who knows? Black Ops III, it's the dumbest title treatment. Yeah.
It's just a fucking title that when you look at it, it gives you, like, a very small headache. It's like, every time I see that title treatment, it's like, ah, my head hurts.
Also, if you were wondering, yes, Red Dead Redemption 2 does have everyone scared, because they are releasing this game a full month earlier than they normally do.
Yeah, it's not November.
It's October 13th, so that they can get it out well ahead of Red Dead, which, yeah, that's going to be interesting.
Yeah, that's probably a smart move.
Does anything come out in November this year, or are they just, like, clearing the field for Red Dead?
It's like, fuck this, yeah.
Yeah, who knows?
Then Rockstar just puts out a tweet that's like, we're tweeting, it's like, we're going to release it a month early, and it's like, Call of Duty's like, no, what?
Yeah.
Fuck you!
Yes. All right. Star Wars news. It never, ever, ever ends.
No.
Jon Favreau, the director of Iron Man, Iron Man 2, Chef, The Jungle Book, great guy, great director, great actor, is showrunning a new Star Wars TV series, live action, I believe, for Disney's upcoming streaming service that they are working on, which I think will be their declaration of war against the world, streaming service.
Their final, like, the flag that they plant in saying that, like, we are going to consume all of culture, and it starts here and now.
It is kind of terrifying to consider that there will soon be a streaming service that has the Disney catalogs of animated films, Pixar, Marvel, Star Wars, all together. Like, that's... Because you kind of probably want to get it, but you're also like, This feels dirty. Yeah. This is wrong.
I gotta finish up my Clone Wars rewatch before it gets ripped off of Netflix.
Yeah. Anyway, that's true. Jesus. Yeah. I wonder what's gonna happen to the Marvel Netflix shows like Jessica Jones and stuff.
Yeah, that's a gonna good be question. Interesting.
But anyway, Jon Favreau's doing this. Look, Jon Favreau's great. Yeah. In the abstract, do I like the idea of Jon Favreau doing something with Star Wars? Yes.
In particular, I would like him to be an actor in Star Wars. I think he'd do very, really good as a general or admiral dude for the rebellion. I think he's just got the right look and demeanor.
Would I personally like Jon Favreau to go do more of his personal indie stuff like Chef because he's really fucking good at it? Yes, but The Jungle Book made $1 billion. He's never doing that again. Once you see that sweet life, you're not going back to making your movie about a chef going around the country in a van. But yes, in the abstract, do I like that idea? Yes. In the larger sense of this, they announced this on International Women's Day. Came after, Star Wars again and again announcing just obvious white guy picks, even when they're very talented, like Rian Johnson, who did a great job on The Last Jedi and is very deserving of this, to getting some more Star Wars movies. It is painfully obvious, especially when you have, International Women's Day was happening, and also the movie in theaters tearing everything up and breaking every record known to man is Black Panther, directed by and created by black people.
Yeah.
And, both men and women. And it's just why, Lucasfilm? You have so many Star Wars things you're making. I dare you, give something to someone who isn't a white man.
Yeah.
Something. And it is bizarre because they have this commitment to diversity in front of the camera on Star Wars that I think is fairly admirable in that in the sequel trilogy, there are four main characters. One is a white dude and it's the bad guy. That's cool. That's interesting. Reflect it behind the camera a little bit because part of the sameness we are all feeling is because this is the same demographic pool you're drawing people out of. And there's nothing wrong with any of these people inherently. That's not the point. The point is that, if you're going to open up Star Wars, you actually need to open up to people who see the world a little differently. That's all. And it is getting weird. It's becoming a parody of itself.
It's especially because it just feels like it's been 6 months of announcement of oh, we're ripping out Lord and Miller and replacing him with fucking Ron Howard. It's white dude. Okay, it's we're replacing Colin Trevorrow, uninspiring, the white dude director. It's taking him off of episode 9. Who are getting to replace him? J.J. Abrams!
Yes.
I would say, personally, totally uninspiring, but uninspired choice, white dude director.
Definitely an uninspired choice, if not an uninspired director.
Yeah.
Those are two different things.
Yeah, and then it's we're going to do another trilogy of movies, and we're going to get Rian Johnson to do it. That's before Last Jedi came out. The Last Jedi came out. He's really fucking good. I'll give you that one. We made a really fucking good Star Wars movie. We'll call Audible on that one. And then we're also going to do a totally separate trilogy of fucking movies, and we're giving it to the Game of Thrones dudes, two white dudes. Okay, and now we're going to do a fucking presumably live-action TV series, and who's showrunning that? Jon Favreau. It just feels like they are pulling out every single sort of middle-aged white dude they can find to make Star Wars, on a dare or something. It's ridiculous.
It really is. I don't understand it. A lot of this has been done, I assume was set up months ago. But at the same time, internally, how is one hand at Disney not talking to the other? How is Lucasfilm not looking over at Black Panther or Thor Ragnarok or any other project in Disney and outside of Disney made by a more diverse set of people and not saying, you know what, maybe we want a piece of that action too. That actually seems like a good idea. It seems so ridiculously tone deaf at a certain point, especially for Star Wars. You can take risks. It's Star Wars. You'll be fine.
Yeah.
Playing it safe is going to drive that series into the ground way faster than taking risks. I think I would plant the flag on that pretty severely.
Yeah,
me
too.
I have another question for you that I think is interesting to think about. So Star Wars Rebels just wrapped up.
Yes, I have yet to watch season 4, but I've watched up through season 3.
Yeah, so you'll catch up on that and tell us what you think about it at some point.
Yeah.
But, that is the team of Dave Filoni and everyone who have been doing the animated shows since the Clone Wars.
Yeah.
Right? The non-Tartakovsky Clone Wars. And do you think they get another show, or are they frozen out after this?
I hope they do. Like, I hope that team gets, like, they're so good. Like, they're really, they've just, like, they've done, especially because since I'm like, doing it, it's like, I'm taking my time with this Clone Wars rewatch. So it's like, I'm watching, like, one or two episodes a day. Like, sometimes I take a day off. But, like, so I'm, like, near the end of season two of Clone Wars, and it just reminds me of, like, they are so fucking good at this. Like, that team and the people they get, the, like, writers they get, and the animators and everybody, like, are so good. They've always been so good. I think, like, I hope someday there's a larger critical recognition of just how good the Star Wars The Clone Wars cartoon is, because it is utterly phenomenal. And, like, what it does with the characters for Star Wars is awesome, but just on its, like, own merits, I think it's a really remarkable program.
Yeah.
I really hope that they get to keep on doing stuff, because it would bum me out they don't replace Rebels with another show.
I just had this thought, because I think this was the day after Rebels ended, and I just thought, oh, I knew they were planning a show for the streaming service. I was kind of assuming that's why Rebels was ending, and they were going to give another, like, what do you guys want to do for your third show? That's our streaming show. That would make complete intuitive sense to me, and it's not. And I just, this is a team that comes from the old Lucasfilm days, when George Lucas was the runner on all this.
Yeah.
And he was very hands-on with things like the Clone Wars, and I think he probably gave some guidance on Rebels. I don't know what exactly it was, but Rebels came out of Clone Wars ending and them having to change the IP a little bit. But it was fundamentally the next step of the Clone Wars in terms of the production line of things, you know? And I just worry that, like, it really seems like Kathleen Kennedy and the higher-ups at Disney, their game is to hire, like, ingratiated Hollywood people, not Star Wars people or people outside of that community.
Yeah.
And I just worry that, like, this could be it for them. And I think there's a non-zero chance that this is it.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. Because that has all kind of been what it's feeling like the Disney buyout has been doing, like, slowly but surely. Because the Disney buyout is, like, directly the thing that caused the Clone Wars to be canceled.
Yes.
Like, Clone Wars was heading towards finishing. Like, it was going to be done. And they pulled the plug out of it.
Well, to be fair, they legally just couldn't continue it because it was a WB show, and it just there were severe rights issues going on where, like, the cost sharing for that kind of thing becomes difficult when you're changing all these corporate hands. So, like, I understand why that. It's the same reason why the Spectacular Spider-Man got canceled when Disney bought Marvel. I don't think anyone wanted to cancel the show. It just literally couldn't continue production. But they did let them go make Rebels. Like, it's not
they kept the team around. But it does feel like you're saying, like, it does feel like some of that stuff is a remnant of what it used to be. Because Rebels does pull, like, it pulls Ahsoka as, like, one of, like, the main characters for season two. It pulls Rex, who's one of the main characters, like, the main clone guy from the Clone Wars. He's one of the main characters of the show from season two onwards. Like, it heavily references stuff from the Clone Wars period, and, like, I do wonder if, like, the new direction for Lucasfilm and everything is, like leave all that stuff behind and, like, focus solely on the new stuff.
It's a weird business strategy. Like, George Lucas was really good at keeping Star Wars a thing with at least some audience, even when there was nothing else going on in the absolute mainstream out in theaters. And I think Disney is kind of missing the forest for the tree, or the trees for the forest in a lot of places, actually, because Star Wars can be a broad brand doing lots of different things, and just homogenizing it all to look and sound like the same thing every time out in every medium is not the way you keep this train going. It just isn't. And I think the first people to tell you that would be the guys next door at Marvel. Like, you know, this is not hard.
Yeah.
You know, Marvel does not, like, the Marvel, like, Netflix shows don't look or feel anything like the main movie ones. And I don't really love those shows, but, like, that is notable that they do that.
Yeah.
And I don't know. Who knows? We haven't seen all this stuff yet. I am worried about the future of Star Wars for all these reasons we've outlined.
Yeah, like, and like, on top of that, it's making me think about, you know, because this is something I'm thinking about a lot as, like, the slow march to E3 in, like, 4 months of Electronic Arts.
Yeah.
And the disaster year that was 2017 for EA, and particularly, like, the fucking cherry on top of the sundae, which was Star Wars Battlefront 2. And I think, like, there were a lot of poor choices made with that game, but a lot of the, like, scuttlebutt that came out, like, basically, like, directly confirmed by some people at EA after that was, like, Disney's direct involvement in that project hampered it significantly. Same thing with the Amy Hennig project. I forget what they called it. But, like, that project, like, the Jason Schreier report afterwards was a lot of, like, it was like, yeah, there's a lot of bad shit going on, but one of the pieces was, like, this really, like, difficult relationship with Disney and trying to get everything approved and everything, like, having the Disney stamp on it. That's like, this is Disney Star Wars, it can do this. And, like, Battlefront 2 had that difficulty, and it's the main reason why Battlefront 2 couldn't have any cosmetic, like, things that you would unlock. And it all ended up having to be gameplay-affecting items, which took the already bad loot box situation and made it, like, 100 times worse when it was, if you spent more money, you would be better at the game because your characters would be more powerful. Like, that's a lot worse than you spend more money and your Darth Vader is pink, you know?
Right.
So, yeah. It's, I think, like, the Disney Star Wars thing is weird and rocky, and I'm very sort of like concerned but interested to see where that property goes in the future.
Yeah. All right. Sean, I've got some cool Doctor Who news.
Good.
We reported on this near the beginning of the year where retailers started listing something called Doctor Who, Tom Baker, The Complete First Season on Blu-ray, and we were really curious, what was this project going to be, if it was even real, you know?
Yeah.
And we finally have an official announcement from BBC Worldwide. This summer, June 11th in the UK, June 26th in the US, we are getting Doctor Who Season 12. And I think in the US it's going to be called Doctor Who Tom Baker Season 1 or something, because I guess they trust US audiences less with the numbering, whatever. But what they are doing is they're doing Blu-ray collections, starting with Tom Baker's first season of Project by the people who have been doing the Doctor Who home video stuff since the beginning of DVD. UK packaging, at least, is awesome. It looks like a digibook kind of thing they're doing, which I'm very excited for. But it's season 12. That's Tom Baker's first season. That one is Robot, Ark in Space, Sontaran Experiment, Genesis of the Daleks, and Revenge of the Cybermen.
Revenge of the Cybermen, yeah.
Something with the Cybermen. I think it's Revenge.
I think it's Revenge. I think Attack of the Cybermen is the sixth Doctor one. I always get the two mixed up.
I think that's... Oh, it's... Yeah, I see it right here. Yes. They are going to have... They've already said they will include all the existing bonus material from the original DVDs, which is a fucking treasure trove. Let me tell you, because I've been collecting. They will also have new features, including a full new one-hour interview with Tom Baker.
Which, if you have never seen interviews with Tom Baker, you should watch some interviews with Tom Baker. That dude is a maniac in the best way.
Bare bones in their DVD releases. They have made new 5.1 surround sound mixes, brand new CGI effects for Revenge of the Cybermen, which matches, if you don't know, that story effects, so they're carrying those over. It'll have the Genesis of the Daleks omnibus movie version. In 75, they broadcast it as one long episode, so they're going to have that on here. They're going to have a 1990 PDF files of all the production archive material, which has been on the DVDs for years, but they're going to collect it also, like, collection of everything for those 20 episodes for those four serials, and that is, I think, fucking awesome that they're doing that. I am almost certainly going to get this.
Yes, I'm going to have to start budgeting.
Yes.
You know?
The one thing to keep in mind, I do not think personally this is a huge downside, but just set your expectations in check. Classic Doctor Who, and a season like this in particular, because this season I don't think, other than Robot, has anything shot on film.
If it doesn't, wouldn't the Sontaran one have a little bit?
No, notably, even though Sontaran Experiment is completely done on location, it was the first one where they experimented with doing video cameras outside. It was actually kind of revolutionary for its time, but it's all videotape because of that. Yeah, so it's all videotape, which is sort of, it is an analog format, but its resolution is much closer to 480p than 1080p. Now, that being said, that does not mean there are no advantages to Blu-ray on that. When people say that, they're not fully understanding the case. This is an analog format. It is not locked the same way, like, the Chris Eccleston episodes are, because those are digitally shot. They are just locked at 480p. I think in that case. These, they are tape. There are things you can do with it. And, like, if you've seen the recent Blu-ray release of Shada, which is the unfinished Tom Baker story, that includes animated material, a lot of 16mm material, those both look pristine on Blu-ray, and some interior videotape material. And even the interior videotape material does look notably better than Doctor Who DVDs have. Now, it's subtle, and if you don't know these kind of different film formats, like, that's fine. That's more of a hobbyist thing. It's fine. But, like, you might not notice it as much. But it will be the best-looking versions of these. Also best-sounding, because they'll get to do the lossless mono soundtracks and things. So, like,
and it's also just, like, thoroughly comprehensive. Yes. Like you said, like, it's including stuff of, like, some of, like, the material they did for VHS releases for some of the stories. It's got some new stuff with, like, the Tom Baker interview. It's nice that they're just, like, making it, like, the most comprehensive collection of these kinds of stories that it seems like you'd be able to do.
Yes, absolutely. So all of that, I think, is very cool. And it helps that this is a season that genuinely if you are a Doctor Who fan, you should own.
Yeah, like, it's a good place to start.
Yeah, you know? It's as good a Doctor Who single season as there is. Mm-hmm. They're all in continuity because it's one long TARDIS trip. It totally makes sense. I think there are other seasons you could pinpoint that might have better visual material for a Blu-ray thing. Although even then, like, it's hard because there is 16mm footage for a lot of the John Pertwee stuff, but they had lost the color for it and they had to recolorize them for DVD.
Yeah, yeah.
And they look pretty good, but I also don't know if you can do anything with those on Blu-ray. It's very hard. The 5th, 6th, and 7th Doctor stuff is really rough visually. So, mm-hmm. like, I think 4th Doctor is going to be the sweet spot for Blu-ray. I'm curious to see if they will do anything with the other Doctors, because it's harder for the 1st and 2nd Doctors because there are no complete seasons that exist. I mean, you could do, like, season 1, we have everything except Marco Polo, and you could do that with a nice recreation. So I think...
Although that would be a big recreation, like, that whole story is missing.
Yeah, so... But it would be worth, you know, that might be a nice bonus.
I think it would be very much worth it. I would love it, but...
I'm just saying that, like, if that might be the thing to draw people in. Like, of seasons 1 through 6, like, that's really the only season you can do. Maybe Patrick Troughton's last one, even that's missing one.
Yeah, I think that would be easier to do that one reconstruction.
Probably, yeah. So it's going to be tough. Marco Polo does have an hour-long reconstruction on the DVD for the Aztecs, which I have.
There you go.
Which is cool. But yes, anyway, so, and then the 3rd Doctor seasons are just... The surviving materials are kind of up and down. I don't know quite how much benefit you would get for the 5th, 6th, and 7th Doctor seasons out of Blu-ray.
Yeah.
But this is an interesting experiment. Even if this is the only season we ever get, it sounds like it'll be a worthwhile box set. And, you know, if they can at least do the 3 Hinchcliffe years, I'm kind of good with that. You know, like, collect those three.
Again, like, if you're going to do one of these, this would probably be the one I would pick. Like, it's a good place to start, like, sort of, like, people, like, I've been listening to some of our classic Doctor Who stuff and want to dive in deeper. Like, I think this is a fantastic place to start watching Doctor Who.
Yeah. There are 2 other classic Who stories on Blu-ray. Spearhead from Space. You should absolutely go buy that because it looks fucking gorgeous. It's all 16mm. Oh, I love that Blu-ray.
And it's also just fucking an awesome story.
Yes. And also Shada, which they went back and completed with animation, and it's so fucking awesome, and you should get that. So anyway, cool stuff with Doctor Who. We'll definitely pick this up this summer and get it. I might import it from the UK for 2 reasons. 1, it seems like the packaging will be cooler. And 2, Doctor Who is usually priced cheaper in the UK because in the US they make many fewer copies of it.
Yeah.
So if you have a region-free Blu-ray player, there's some money-saving tips for you. Anyway, yes, let's move on to our next news item. Sean, Days Gone for the PS4, the weird zombie game, has been delayed to 2019.
The biker zombie game. That maybe will help people remember what it is.
Very prematurely delayed to 2019, so they know they need some time on it. This was on your draft for games that were going to get pushed at the number 4 seed. So I have one in Anthem. You have one in Days Gone. So we have 2.
But Anthem was like your number 1, wasn't it?
I think, Anthem was only my number 2 or 3. So, okay. Like, I'm not... My number 1 is Kingdom Hearts 3.
Oh, right.
So,
yeah.
And your number 1, I think, is Pokemon Gen 8 for Switch.
Yeah.
So, yeah. We will see. But yes.
But I got one on the board.
Yes. Very good. All right. Now, I'm actually going to move our outline around a little bit. Let's next do our Nintendo Direct talk. Okay?
Okay.
So I'm going to run through the Nintendo Direct stuff. Okay? So we had a Nintendo Direct. They very last minute announced this, that it was going to be for February... It was the March 8th Direct. So we finally got another Direct, which was nice. And for the most part, this was a very nice little Direct. It had some good surprises. A lot of ports, but they're ports of things people want to play on Switch. You know, they're not shoving anything down our throats, it feels like. So that's nice. And then we got to the end, and they psyched us all out by surprise announcing Smash Bros. And basically teeing themselves up for E3, I think is how I read that. But yeah, it was a pretty good Nintendo Direct.
Yeah, I was surprised by how much it had. Like, I was expecting it to be a bit lighter. It had like a decent amount of stuff.
Yeah, they. I think Nintendo's doing okay right now.
Yeah.
So let's go through what we had. All right. They started with a Nintendo 3DS block. The 3DS. My takeaway from all the 3DS stuff is that very clearly Nintendo has moved every team they have over to the Switch, and they've left some interns over here to do some remakes or something.
Yeah.
But, you know, that seems like probably the best they can do right now, because the 3DS is awesome and it is still selling, But, you know, you can't justify pulling resources away from the Switch right now, obviously. Yeah. So, but here's what we have. So the first announcement is a new WarioWare game, WarioWare Gold. It is coming to 3DS on August 3rd. It is a compilation WarioWare game with over 300 of the micro games from games throughout the series, as well as some new ones. This seems great. I would like eventually a WarioWare game for Switch, but you would also have to do that from the ground up for obvious reasons. Yeah. This is a compilation of all the portable stuff. Makes total sense for 3DS. I have not played WarioWare in forever, but I do love those games. And this seems like a good way to just like take a trip down memory lane. And a cool... This seems like the right kind of thing to be doing at this point in the 3DS's lifespan.
Yeah, it's just like... WarioWare felt like it was dormant for a long time. In such a way that I kind of like forgot that that was a thing that Nintendo did.
I don't... I could be totally wrong. I don't think it's had a 3DS release.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's correct. Yeah.
All right, then we learned about Dylan's Dead Heat Breakers. I don't know what this game is. I don't either,
because I did not watch the Nintendo Direct. I only watched like the videos afterwards that I was interested in. Most of them on the Japanese Nintendo YouTube channel, to which I am subscribed for reasons that are too complicated to get into.
It's got a fox. I don't really know what it is. It's coming out May 24th. Then we learned that Mario & Luigi Bowser's Inside Story, which is the third Mario & Luigi game, is being ported / remade to the 3DS, which is a la Superstar Saga, which they did last year, if you'll remember, in October. They are skipping the second Mario & Luigi Partners in Time, which is too bad because that is a good game that is sadly overlooked. But I have always heard people say Bowser's Inside Story is either the best or second best behind or above Superstar Saga. I've always wanted to play it. I never have. I'm excited to play it this way. It isn't coming until 2019. That's weird. I don't know why Nintendo never announces stuff this early in terms of this kind of thing.
Yeah, especially something like a remake of a game. That's weird to sort of like...
Yeah,
put that goalpost that far.
But it's coming eventually, so there we go. I'll play it when it comes out, probably. Or who knows?
I have breaking news. I have gone onto Wikipedia, Jonathan, and I have discovered that the last... I guess you count this as a Wario game. The last WarioWare game was Game & Wario for the Wii U, which was 2013. Before that, it was WarioWare DIY, which was 2009 in Japan, 2010 over here, which I believe that was on the DS. So
it was DS and WiiWare. Yeah. It was both of those. Yeah, it was because those were your made your own games. Yeah.
So it's been since 2010 over here since you had a game that had WarioWare in the title.
Interesting. So yeah, that's cool. I'm glad we're getting it back. Wario's awesome. Wario doesn't get enough love.
Yeah.
He's one of the best. Okay. Detective Pikachu got a little showcase. We already knew it's coming out March 23rd. They just reminded us of it. This game looks good, and the actor they got for English for Detective Pikachu is great, and I wish he was just doing it for the movie and not fucking Ryan Reynolds, but oh well.
Yeah, and I like that they basically went in the same direction with the English voice actor as the Japanese voice actor, which is like weird, like gruff old man Pikachu.
I still wish it was Danny DeVito. But, you know.
Yeah, that's too much.
You can't always get what you want, but sometimes you get what you need. Yeah. This is probably what we need, but I want Danny DeVito.
Yeah.
And if I have time, I do want to try to play this game, because what the fuck is this game?
It looks pretty fucking crazy.
And here was one of the biggest surprises of the day. Luigi's Mansion, the GameCube classic, is getting a full remake for 3DS. It will be available later this year. No date. Kind of surprising this is a 3DS game and not a Switch game. It makes sense in so much as there is a 3DS sequel called Luigi's Mansion Dark Moon that has been popular over the years. It's a Nintendo Select game now, so it must have done well. Assumedly they were just able to take that engine and slap Luigi's Mansion into it.
Yeah, I bet they probably reused a lot of the same models and stuff.
Yeah, so, and also some people pointed out that, like, Luigi's Mansion is a pretty... I saw this on Reddit. People pointed out Luigi's Mansion is a pretty short game. If you were to just plop that on Switch for $60 or even $40, I think a lot of people would kind of cry foul once they actually played it. But as a 3DS title, I think it'll feel very much at home there. I thought that was a smart point. And I do think, like, all things considered, this does probably make sense as something from Nintendo's past to get out there again on 3DS.
I do think that point is like a pretty vicious, like underhanded way of throwing some shade at Luigi's Mansion, because Luigi's Mansion was a full console game when it was originally released.
It was also a launch title.
Luigi's Mansion, but it was a weird thing to launch the GameCube with.
I've never played it all the way through, so I'm actually excited to see it this way, because I've also never played the sequel. This will be a good chance to do both.
Yeah.
So no date. I assume that will be a like summer or October thing, one of the two. All right. Then we moved over to the Nintendo Switch showcase. They reminded us about Kirby Star Allies, and this was cool. Legacy characters like Meta Knight, King Dedede, other major Kirby characters can become your friends / allies during the game through free updates that they will be doing on a like bi-weekly basis for a while. So they will be doing basically free DLC for several months, adding in more characters. Looks fun.
Yeah, I'm glad that that's not like an amiibo thing or something. It's just like they're just giving it to the people.
That is, you are, I had not thought of that. Oh, thank God.
Yeah.
All right. Okami HD from Capcom is coming to the Nintendo Switch. It is eShop only, not a physical release, which is pissing off some people, I'm sure. I do wish I could get it physically, but, you know, I'm not going to get my panties in a bunch about it. But coming this summer, no date yet. I'm so glad. I have always wanted to play Okami. I never have. It came out on PS4 last year, and I came this close to buying it, and I think a voice in my head said, but what if it comes out for Switch, Jonathan? That's where you want to play Okami in your heart of hearts. And I waited, and I was right. It's coming to Switch. Very excited to play this one.
Yeah, and it's just like, Okami has always seemed like a very Nintendo-esque game. Like, it's always felt like it was, I never played it, but the scuttlebutt around it was like, it's like the best non-Zelda Zelda game.
So. Well, like, the director of that game, who's also the director of Bayonetta, I forget his name, but he's directly said Zelda was the biggest influence on it. So, like, and his games, the Bayonetta games, are on here now. It feels like the stuff that guy does is very much in the Nintendo wheelhouse. So,
this is maybe cutting ahead a bit, but they should totally make Amaterasu the Wolf a character in Smash Bros.
That'd be awesome.
That's fucking...
They have a lot that they could do.
That's just on... There you go.
I saw someone on Twitter today say this, and it's so true. Doom is now on Switch. Doom Marine needs to be in Smash Bros, and his Smash attack would be amazing.
But except for you have to play... You're playing from the first-person view if you're playing as the Doom Marine. And it's, like, really weird because the stage is very narrow. But, like, it should just be that you're playing Doom, and it's, like, all the fucking Mario's jumping around, and you fucking shoot him in the face with a shotgun, run in and just, like, rip his fucking head off and, like, throw it off the stage, and that's how he loses.
Yes. All right. Sushi Striker, The Way of the Sushido, is coming to Switch. I guess this has been on 3DS before. It has full anime cutscenes, which looks cool. It is a sushi-based puzzle game. It looks crazy. It's coming June 8th. I don't know if this is something I will play, but it looks delightfully weird, and, you know, I like seeing that.
Yeah. As a pedantic person who can also speak Japanese, I think calling it Way of the Sushido is very redundant, because Sushido already means Way of the Sushi.
Okay, that's true.
It's the Sushi Dodo.
Sushi Dodo. All right. Masashi Takahashi from Square Enix appeared to talk about Project Octopath Traveler. He introduced the merchant Tressa and the apothecary Alfin, two of the characters that you will play as, talked more about the job system, which seems cool, and announced that this game is launching July 13th, 2018. There will be a very cool special edition with a pop-up book with all the characters mirroring the pop-up art style, the 2D or the 2.5D pixel art thing they're doing with that game. And it looks like the title of the game is officially just Octopath Traveler.
So they're dropping the project.
Dropping project, but I also love that they're not, like, sanitizing that title. It's just Octopath. I wish it was still just Project Octopath Traveler, because that's such a great... That sounds like a great, like, Japanese folk band.
Yeah.
But still, it's great. I love that it survives. This is not a Xbox Scorpio to Xbox One X situation, where it's called, like, you know... Dream of Butterflies or something. No, that's a Persona song. Sorry.
It is.
I don't know. I'm trying to think of some generic JRPG title. I don't know.
Like Village Quest Adventure.
Yes, something like that. Anyway, but yes, Octopath Traveler coming out July 13th. This game looks fucking amazing, so I'm excited.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the Bravely Default people. What more do I have to say? Travis Strikes Again, No More Heroes, coming to Switch in 2018. I don't know what this is, but I feel like I should. What's No More Heroes?
That was a... Oh, fuck, I can't remember. It's a Suda51, like that studio.
Oh.
I think the first two games were like Wii games, or maybe the first one was like PS2 and the second one was Wii, something like that.
Suda51 showed up at a previous Nintendo thing to say he was working on something. So
yes.
I think
that's probably the culmination of that. Yeah, he just sort of showed up, rambled on stage in Japanese for a little bit. The guy who translated for it didn't translate any of that stuff. It just said... I'm working on a new project that is going to be on the Nintendo Switch. And then, Suda51 very kindly walked off the stage.
All right. Dark Souls Remastered got a showcase. Looks really good. There's going to be a network test for the Switch before launch. And the Solaire of Astora amiibo is being released, which looks awesome.
The fucking somehow, like, the weird meme, like meme attachment to that Solaire character has gone so far as to make him an amiibo, which feels like a... like sick joke from 2014 or something that has now come real in some bizarre way.
I do love when the amiibos get weird, so this is nice.
Because
I like
it's
that.
Straight up him in like the praise the sun pose for like anyone who's played Dark Souls knows what that is. It's like they fucking went for it.
I just like that Dark Souls is coming to Switch and they are so clearly embracing it into the Nintendo family. It's funny.
Yeah.
It makes me laugh.
I really wish that they had an amiibo of the, I forget what I think it's called like the Rotting Dragon or the Crawling Dragon, which is one of the bosses from Dark Souls, which is the bottom half of a dragon's corpse that just goes crazy and attacks you. This giant rotting zombie corpse that like half of it is just the exposed rib cage with like bits of meat falling off. That should have been the amiibo they made. It would have been awesome.
All right. Mario Tennis Aces then got a big showcase. It was about a 5-minute trailer. Long, and normally I would resent that for a tennis game, but this game looks unusually good. They showed off that it's going to have over 15 characters. It'll have full 4-player local and online multiplayer. A bunch of new tennis moves they have added. It looks, I wrote, crazy and goofy, but also sort of deep and strategic. Lots and lots of different modes. You can kind of play however you want, including traditional tennis rules. There will be motion controls included, a la Wii Tennis, but they are by no means required. And they finally announced it is getting a release date June 22nd. It will have a pre-launch tournament before launch. And I gotta say, I have not played a Mario Tennis or a Mario Sports game in forever. I think I'm gonna buy this. This looks really good. And it's gonna have that full story mode and everything. Like, this looks like a cool game.
It's like, it's something that we just don't get a lot of those more arcadey sports games. Like, I used to really like old tennis and golf games and stuff. It just feels like that kind of mostly went away, and you get a couple of them every once in a while. So
yes, looks fun. And then I wrote in my notes, all caps, Captain Motherfucking Toad! Captain, my boy, Captain Motherfucking Toad, he is coming to Switch. He was stranded on the Wii U, but now all can experience the glory of Captain Toad and his globe-trotting adventures. They will have new levels from Super Mario Odyssey. It looks fucking awesome. They've added co-op. It'll also be on 3DS if you swing that way. Coming July 13th, same day as same day as Project Octopath Traveler, which is a little bit whiplashy for me, but I'm going to be getting both. I cannot wait. Captain Toad's the best.
Okay.
Yeah. Captain Motherfucking Toad.
Okay.
I wish that's what they called the game.
I think that they would have run into a little bit of trouble.
Remind us what he's called in Japanese.
Oh, I don't remember. I think...
Is it Saicho or something like that?
I'm going to look it up because you put me on the spot there.
It's great. Okay, Undertale, the indie sensation, is coming to Switch. No date. Crash Bandicoot, Insane Trilogy, is coming to Switch July 10th. That's
you
kind of
traitor, Crash Bandicoot. You can't jump to a Nintendo console. That's like Sonic being on a Nintendo console. It's unheard of.
It is kind of wild. I will not have time to play that in July, but I do one day want to play the Crash Bandicoot games. Little Nightmares Complete Edition is coming to Switch May 18th.
That game always seemed interesting, but like I never heard much about it. Like,
yeah,
it always looked like it was like inside, but not inside.
Yeah, I had not heard of it before this. It looks kind of interesting. South Park, The Fractured Butthole is coming to Switch on April 24th.
That was like one of the bits of the Nintendo Direct I did watch because I just wanted to see the Nintendo person have to try to say that title.
Yes, it is interesting. Fuck you, South Park. Hyrule Warriors Definitive Edition is coming May 18th. God damn it, I wrote in my notes, too many May games because May is the month where they're releasing a bunch of ports of games I've never played to the Switch that I really want to play. They've got Hyrule Warriors on the 18th, they've got Donkey Kong Country Tropical Freeze on the 4th, and they've got Dark Souls Remastered on the 25th, and I want to play all three of those. That's going to be an expensive month, but we will see. ARMS is getting a US-Canada tournament in March, another global test punch for people who have not bought the game yet on March 31st. And then we had our final thing on Splatoon. But Sean, did you find the name of Captain
it's
Toad?
It's Kinopio Taicho.
Kinopio Taicho. I love that.
Kinopio Taicho is a very good name.
And isn't it? Is it? It's Go Forth, Captain Toad, right? It's the title. What
yes.
is it?
Hold on. It's more hard to Google this than you would expect.
No, I know. Yeah. It's Kinopio Taicho, like, something. It's not Ikimasu. It's like...
It's going to take a second to find this. Names in other languages. Susume Kinopio Taicho, which is onward Kinopio Taicho, or like march. Susume!
I love that. Susume Kinopio Taicho, it's the best title.
It's really good. It sells me on Captain Toad in a way that Captain Toad Treasure Tracker does not at all.
It's such a good game. Such a good game. Okay. Splatoon 2 then got a block at the end of the show. It is getting a version 3.0 in April for free. They will be adding 100 new pieces of gear to the game, 3 new stages, all of which look awesome, a new rank for people who play the ranked multiplayer. You can go above rank S+ and now do rank X. So for like they have supported Splatoon 2 a ton over the last year. They've added new stages, new gear, all of this stuff is for free. This new stuff is for free. So that's awesome that they've supported it that way. Splatoon 2 is a great game. But then we got this weird little Splatoon short film that had rad music. It was kind of weird. Something about a subway and an evil squid clone people and bosses. And it became clear over the course of this little short film that this is a new single-player campaign. They announced it is Splatoon 2 The Octo Expansion. It is a paid DLC that is a hefty new single-player mode. The trailer says 80 new stages.
Oh, geez.
Do you know how many stages the base game has? About 30. So, like, okay. This is nuts. Like, I realized I had not finished it all, so I went back the other day and finished the whole Splatoon 2 campaign. And it's great. I had forgotten, like, the single player in Splatoon 2 is so good and so overlooked. So it's pretty cool that they're doing more of it. And this feels like this is a proper, like, standalone, full-on campaign with new areas, and it's a new character and all this. I'm very excited. The Splatoon single-player stuff is this really, like, unique blend of platforming and puzzle-solving and shooting, and it is just so special. One of our podcast listeners actually tweeted me saying, yeah, that trailer was so good, I went and bought Splatoon 2, even though I have kind of no interest in the multiplayer. And I'm like, it is weirdly worth it for it. It's a very good single-player game.
Especially if they're adding this much single-player stuff, it seems even more worth it if you just want to play the single-player.
Yeah. And it's only $20.
Yeah.
$20 for all that. You can buy it now, and they give you some new little gear things. So I had some credit in my account, so I went ahead and just grabbed it, because I've been playing some of the multiplayer on Splatoon 2 in between things, and I just put on my new gear, and it was cool. I think the Splatfest is about to end for the weekend. It was the chicken versus the egg. What came first was the Splatfest. I was on side of Team Chicken came first for whatever reason.
It's you know, I think it's a complicated, like, you have to define your terms, because like the egg as a thing occurred first, but like the chicken egg specifically, like that's different than just eggs generically.
Yes. So I don't know who won yet. It was kind of fun to play. The egg side was shooting yellow paint, which made sense. The chicken side was shooting white paint, which I guess made sense. It just made me think of, like, you were shooting chicken jizz or something. It was very strange. But yes. Anyway.
Chickens are female.
We learned about... That's a good point. They're squirting. We learned about Splatoon 2, the Octo Expansion.
Okay.
And I know... I know
sometimes
that's not.
You have to censor yourself, my friend.
I understand. I really should cut that. I'm not going to, because it takes too long to edit.
Yeah.
But... That was a joke. My understanding of anatomy is better than that. I want to make that clear.
Let's move on.
The Splatoon 2 Octo Expansion, they showed that. And then they came back. And I should also say they had someone from the Splatoon lab doing funny poses during this. It was very funny. And anyway, the hosts came back and said, like, oh, we hope you've enjoyed this Nintendo Direct. Oh, we've got one more thing. They did, like, the Steve Jobs thing. One more thing. And it went to black, came back up, and it was more Splatoon. And in my notes, I wrote, oh, kind of a letdown. They're running around. I wrote, maybe this is like an animated series they're doing or something. But wait, no. In the eye of one of the Squid Kids, you see the Smash Bros. Logo reflected.
Well, it's more than that. It starts as just like you said, it looks like it's like a Splatoon animated, like 3D animated show or something. And then it's just like them running around shooting at each other. It's like, oh, this looks like a commercial for Splatoon 2. And then like this noise starts playing, and like this ominous music starts building up, and this like light starts shining on the back of the Splatoon girl, and she stops in her tracks and like slowly, fearfully looks over her shoulder, and then her eyes and her expression widens in surprise and fear, and it zooms in on the people as the pupil resolves into the reflection of the Smash Brothers logo wreathed in flame. Leaved in hellish fire.
It was, in the moment, live, a hell of a way to reveal that. Because, like, look, intellectually, we all know Smash Bros. Is coming eventually. I think there had been kind of a consensus building that it was probably going to be their big fall game this year. But by no means was it guaranteed. And my brother asked me before that started, he's like, do you think we're going to see Smash Bros.? And I said, no way, that's an E3 thing. If they're doing it this year, that's an E3 thing. That was crazy.
Yeah.
It was pretty cool. I think people have been analyzing way too much out of those, like, 30 seconds.
It's getting ridiculous.
But we're going to do it. It's okay. look, we're getting new Smash Bros. This year. Sorry to almost every other game on my top 10 list this year. Smash Bros. Is going to beat the competition probably because it's fucking Smash Bros. We're going to get it on Switch. I'm so excited. I cannot wait. Total power move to just put up that fucking logo and nothing else, end the show, and have us all wait with bated breath for E3.
I do wish that they had clarified exactly what it is, because there have been so many rumors since the Switch announced that they are going to do a port of Super Smash Bros. 4, which is Super Smash Bros. 4 3DS and Super Smash Bros. 4 Wii U. And, I'm assuming that this is a quote-unquote Smash Bros. 5, but, that's been frustrating of seeing, the fans online rip themselves to pieces trying to sort of, debate this undebatable question until Nintendo just says, definitively, this is a whole new Super Smash Bros. Game, or this is the old Smash Bros. Game with a lot of new content.
My guess is it's actually somewhere in between that, and, I think if it were just a straight port, they wouldn't announce it like this because it doesn't really fit how they've announced ports for the Switch. They didn't do this for Mario Kart 8 Deluxe or something, right? But Smash Bros. Also isn't Mario Kart, to be fair, in terms of the fan hype and love and sales. Well, not necessarily sales.
Mario Kart's a beast in the sales.
It is. But, I think it will be a proper Smash Bros. 5, but I also think it will be less different. I think the delta between this and the previous game will be less than it's ever been for a Smash Bros. Because I don't know what all, 4 years later, how much different it can be. I think this will kind of be like, and I've seen some people say this, and so I'm kind of borrowing this point, like the Splatoon 2 of Smash Bros.
Right.
Which is, Splatoon 2 is a proper sequel. It is not just a rehash of what Splatoon 1 did. It has new maps, it has some new mechanics, new central hub, new campaign for single player stuff. So all of that is there. But you can't ignore that, obviously, its foundation is pretty much the first game. I'm guessing the gameplay will be fairly similar. I think it'll have most of the roster from last time with plenty of new things and people and stages. And I think it'll have a mix of these things. I think we're going to get, whatever they do for single player is going to have to be all new, because 3DS and Wii U had different single player things.
Right.
And different bonus modes. So I think all of that's going to be overhauled and whatnot. I do think it'll be a proper overall Smash 5. I just also don't think it'll be, it's not going to feel like Melee to Brawl or Brawl to Wii U, because I don't know. And maybe I'm totally wrong on that. I could be, but in 4 years, and within those 4 years, they were still actively developing for Wii U with all the DLC for a good year and a half, 2 years, It just hasn't been that long. But I also think Smash Bros. Is worth the effort to not just port it, right?
Right.
To make it a big new thing. And I think whatever it is, it will be good and probably worth the hype. But it is interesting, and I agree. I think Nintendo probably should have been a little clearer. It is a different, it's a new logo. It's, they announced it in very dramatic fashion. The little hint you see of Link, he's in Breath of the Wild gear, and they have not changed Link's character model since Melee, I think. So,
Brawl, they used Twilight Princess.
That's true. So, yeah. But he's been Twilight Princess Link for 2 games in a row. So, they're clearly changing some things up. But, yeah, it's very vague.
Yeah, in just calling it Super Smash Brothers is, you have 3 games that are basically just called Super Smash Brothers, if you count the 3DS and Wii U ones as 2 different games, which they kind of are and kind of aren't.
This is the one thing. They're probably just going to call it Smash Bros. For Nintendo Switch. That will make me so sad.
That also doesn't clarify it. If at E3, they didn't say anything about it other than the official title is Super Smash Bros. For Nintendo Switch, we'd be having the same argument if that's a remake or port, or if it's a whole new game.
Here's what I think they're... You know what? Actually, this is the prediction. This is the flag I'm going to plant in the sand. I'm guessing, with no evidence, but I think this is what we're going to get. I think it's just going to be called Super Smash Bros. With that exact title treatment. They're going to pull a Doom 2016 or God of War 2018, and it'll just be called Super Smash Bros. I think that seems likely to me.
Yeah, that would be equivalent if the last God of War game had been called God of War for PlayStation 3,
yes,
and the last Doom game had been called Doom for, personal computers and everything else, instead of Doom 3.
I think Doom for personal computers is Windows Vista.
Yeah.
Hey-o!
Oh,
sorry.
Jesus Christ. You're having a fucking podcast, aren't you?
I'm a little punchy tonight. Yeah, I don't know what it is. Anyway.
But yeah, it's like, Super Smash Brothers is awesome. It's awesome that they're making a new one. I just wish that they're, and I think that the video they put out is fucking amazing. I love, immediately on Twitter, I saw someone got retweeted into my timeline that had that, it's that Linkin Park song, but in the end, it doesn't, that song, they put that over it. And it was so, and it cuts to the chorus line right when it cuts to the very stern Mario that's in the shadow of the flaming cross of Super Smash Brothers, and it cuts to Link, and it's it was pitch perfect. It was so good. So yeah, that video is great. I think there's just I feel like video games are the only thing that does this, where you have an announcement for a new product and everybody falls over and scrambles, not even knowing what the product is. And they're and the fans just go crazy arguing back and forth on forums about whether or not this is a brand new Smash Brothers game, and outlining silhouettes in this fucking thing and saying no, there's all these new characters. It's this is crazy. You can just say, and it doesn't even have to be in your Nintendo Direct if you want to be this big surprise. Just put out a press release right after that clarifies it, that then gets disseminated, you know?
Yeah. We did learn over Twitter that Masahiro Sakurai, the creator and director of the other four Smash Bros. Games, is working on it. We don't know in what capacity. For all the other games, he's been very open on blogs and Twitter about everything. Obviously, Nintendo wasn't talking about it yet, so he couldn't be.
Yeah.
So, remains to be seen what his capacity is. It will be interesting to see if this is the first Smash Bros. Not, directed by him. Maybe he's just producing or something, which is fine. That happens with games, and people move on to different capacities. Shigeru Miyamoto doesn't direct Mario games anymore, and they're still good. So, very curious about that, though.
I also have a new pitch for the title. I think in this modern era, I think is incredibly insensitive for the title to be gender exclusive with Super Smash Brothers. It should be Super Smash Siblings.
I thought you were going to say Super Smash Brothers and Sisters.
It could be that. I think Siblings is a bit smoother and you get a three S's.
Not Super Smash Sibs. We're not going to simplify it.
I mean, you can if you want. That sounds weird and kind of dirty in some way. Sibs. I don't
Super
like
Smash
that.
People.
Yeah, Super Smash Persons.
Yes. All right. Super Smash Siblings. Very excited for it. I still think, way back, the old podcast joke, you thought they should call 3DS and Wii U Roughhousing and Tussle?
Yeah.
I still think they should pick one of those.
Yeah, I'm very disappointed that they didn't continue with their, weird naming sequel trend with Melee and Brawl.
Yes, Super Smash Bros. Roughhousing is still available, Nintendo. You don't have to pay us for it.
Yeah, it's
just
free.
Just take the idea. All right. Sean, let's see. I'm making an audible that we are going to be splitting up this episode because this has taken too long, and I'm going to do the Annihilation thing as its own episode later, and it can be a short thing we release separately.
Okay.
So let's finish with two topics.
Two topics.
We're going to do a serious topic, which is video game violence and the White House.
Which is, serious and not also, serious at the same time. In a weird
more intellectually rigorous, let's say.
Yes.
Then we're going to do a stupid topic where I will on the fly rank Mario games.
Good. And the most violent of all the video games.
And then you can come back later this week or next week for our discussion of Annihilation. Does that sound good?
That sounds good to me.
Okay. Let's start with this. Sean, this week, President Donald Trump still doesn't feel right to say that.
President idiot.
President Donald Trump asterisk. I'm just going to go with that. If Barry Bonds has an asterisk, then Donald Trump should have a fucking asterisk. Anyway, held a meeting asterisk. All of this has an asterisk at the White House asterisk of some people from the video game industry, some conservative Republicans, Congress people who have, and senators who have spoken out against video games. And some people from, the Parents TV Council or some fucking stupid organization like that. And they talked about violence in video games, apparently. Trump showed a clip reel he got off YouTube, I think, of violence.
Very good.
One of the games most prominently featured in it was Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2, which came out the year... no, not even 2000. That game is 2009.
Yes.
So that was while we were in high school. That game is almost a decade old.
Yeah,
so
that was a year into Obama's first term.
So we are super hip with the times on the references here. The video game people said the standard line that, look, there's no evidence for this. You should focus on gun control. And they were all nah, bro, you're fucking with the kids on all this.
Yeah.
And nothing really came out of it. They didn't allow any cameras or journalists in the room, which is not Trump's normal MO. So the whole thing was just bizarre. I mean, the whole thing was Trump fired this off on Twitter that he was going to invite people. They didn't actually invite people for a week. When they did, a couple people came. It total clusterfuck because Donald Trump's a fucking idiot, right?
It was utterly performative. Like, yes. There is nothing of substance occurred. Nothing, no decision will be made. Nothing will, I do not think that anything will come of this.
No, obviously
it's
not.
It's just, I mean, the only thing that will come of this is that it is yet another distraction to throw into the path of any serious discussion about legislation around gun control. Like, that's
or
like,
any of the substantive reasons why we have so many gun deaths in the United States.
Yeah, it is just another, if they're resurrecting like long dead excuses that feel like we stopped using last decade, you know?
Yes. Look, Trump's gonna Trump. And, you know, whatever. I will actually say, on this podcast, you know, over a year ago when we did our One Politics episode after the election, and I said, I don't think Donald Trump is the most dangerous thing here. He's a fucking idiot. I think the dangerous people are the people enabling him around him. I think I have been proven thoroughly correct on that point over the last year because, you know, he has no ideology or agenda, and it's come completely through the Republican Congress, and they have also completely, you know, given in to his worst actions and allowed those to go through. And I think this is another example of that, because the people I am most mad at for this meeting, it's not Donald Trump, it's not the Republican senators, it's not the weird fucking people from the parents' organization who go around yelling, please think of the children, while not understanding anything in the world.
Yeah.
It's what self-respecting video game executive goes to this thing? Well, I'll tell you. They were Robert Altman, the CEO of ZeniMax, the parent company for games. This is from the Washington Post. Such as Fallout, Strauss Zelnick, the chief executive of Take-Two Interactive, known for Grand Theft Auto, and Michael Gallagher, the leader of the Entertainment Software Association, a Washington-focused lobbying organization for the industry. What are you doing dignifying this bullshit in the year 2018, allowing this to become a distraction, completely playing into Trump's conversation? Because even if you go there and mount a sterling defense for your industry, what you have done is chosen to frame the debate completely on his weird, batshit crazy 1995 terms.
Yeah.
And I'm sick of it. Like, stand up for yourselves, say no, video games did not kill 17 people in Parkland, Florida. Video games did not take 3 people hostage in a VA hospital this weekend. You might not have heard about that. That happened. Crazy guy killed 3 people in a hospital. You know, video games didn't do these things. They had no part in these things. Do your job, pass some legislation.
Yeah.
That's what you say, and you don't allow it to be on his terms. Because this, you know, are there discussions to be had about how our culture engages with violence in media? Yes, obviously there are. Is that discussion on the same level of priority as our country's fetishism for guns, gun violence, and lax gun laws? No, it is not. And even if it was, is video games such an exclusive part of this conversation that we have to talk about it and never mention any other form of media? No. I am sick of pretending this is a real conversation. It isn't. It never has been. No one who has put this forward has ever been intellectually honest about it or had good, non-cynical intentions. And that includes people on the right and left. You know, I supported Hillary Clinton pretty vocally in the presidential campaign. She was responsible for getting this ball started in the 90s. One of the people who did that in the 90s.
Yeah.
And during her Senate campaign. So, like, this is a problem the left and right have had, the right more, but, like, it needs to stop. This is not the issue. There are, you know, the evidence is in. It has been in forever. Video games do not cause people to go do violent things. And if you think that that's still the conversation you're having, you know literally nothing about video games, because that's not the landscape of what has cultural cachet anymore in the video game landscape.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay? So that's my opening statement on this. Sean?
Yeah, for me, like, obviously, I agree with everything you just said, and then I would add to it, like, the broader historical perspective of, like, it feels insane to, like, be here sitting, like, talking about this. Like, not just that, like, video games have come back around the cycle, and we're doing it with the same thing again, but just that, like, broader speaking, that our culture has not grasped this concept of the separation between the things that people do and the kinds of media we like very generically create, that this is like the exact same kind of weird hysteria that has been going around fucking forever. And it's like, whether you're talking about like gothic horror literature in the Victorian period, whether you're talking about like horror comic books and horror films in the 50s, you know, whether you're talking about rock and roll music in the 50s or like, you know, Marilyn Manson, like whatever you're talking about, like Dungeons and Dragons in the fucking 70s and 80s, where they made that ridiculous, like really early, like super like babyface Tom Hanks movie, Mazes and Monsters, which is all about how Mazes and Monsters, which is your Dungeons and Dragons equivalent, is like indoctrinating children into Satanism and causing them to murder people. You know, like we do this exact same fucking thing over and over and over and over again, and it is always to distract from a real problem, or it's like sometimes it's to distract from there being no problem at all. I would say that's mostly like what the rock and roll thing was, is like there's nothing there, but it'll be used to distract from like problems that are created by, you know, drugs. It'll be problems that are created by guns. It'll be problems that are created by other social factors that are much more complicated to deal with, or that people do not want to have to go through everything to deal with it, because they have to realize some more uncomfortable truths about the positions that they hold, and so they find some ridiculous media scapegoat to throw it at. And it's like, it's always been happening. One of my favorite interviews I've ever seen is an interview from the 50s with Orson Welles that I think happened on like the BBC or something. It was some British interview. You can find it on YouTube, where he's talking about, like, it's this exact same conversation, but it's about horror films and horror comic books specifically in the 50s. And he's talking about how, like some the British, like, snobby British person keeps on pestering on this point of, like, what, you don't think that this is causing people to go out and go crazy and go murder people? And, like, well, Orson Welles just eventually says it's like, no, because if it did, you know, like, people would have been, in the Elizabethan times, would have been doing some pretty remarkable things if they had coming right out of the theater, because, you know, fucking everybody dies at the end of Hamlet, you know, some pretty atrocious shit happens in Shakespeare's Titus Andronicus, like, nobody was going in and, like, chopping people up and making them into fucking pies as a national fucking epidemic of behavior in, like, the year 1600. This isn't how, like, behavioral psychology works. We have known that since before we had behavioral psychology, and yet we are still having this fucking conversation time and time and time and time again. We will never get away from this. Humanity will never learn from its own mistakes. If you're a student of history or literature or anything, you realize that that's true, that there are just some things that it seems like our culture will just never be able to escape from till the end of our whole fucking species. And it is a really fucking depressing realization to come to.
And it kills the nuance in related conversations.
Yes.
Because, you know, I think there are very real conversations to have, as I said, about violence in media in general and how we portray and consume it. I also think there are, in the video game space particularly, very toxic subcultures right now that are, you know, the alt-right that birthed Donald Trump and our current wave of neo-Nazism was in part grown online in the Gamergate movement.
Yeah.
That cannot be ignored. That cannot be suppressed. We have not shied away from talking about that. I think any hopefully self-respecting video game, you know, critic or observer of the industry would not shy away from talking about these things. But that also has nothing to do with this stupid claim that, oh, if we just didn't have video games, then no one would shoot anybody, because guns don't encourage any violence. Sure, they're deadly weapons that allow you to have the power of life in the palm of your fucking hand at any moment, and they're super easy to get, and they encourage you to do violent shit because that's what they are there for. But no, it's the video games. The guns don't do anything, guys. It's the video. If Grand Theft Auto 5 clearly makes people go kill prostitutes, right?
Yeah.
Because there's been this wave of prostitute killing epidemic in the United States, apparently. Where is it's just, it's such an old conversation.
Yeah.
You know, this was a huge thing after Columbine, because the Columbine shooters played Doom, and they built maps in Doom that were Columbine High School. And they, like, practiced the shooting in there. And that's obviously some pretty disturbing stuff. The video game, you know, industry, the video game art form, the video game culture was very, very different back then. And yet the conversation about how it's the video game's fault has not changed as video games or the times have changed since then. we were 7 years old when Columbine happened in 1999, 6 or 7. And it is now 2018. You and I are both 25. Most of our lives, this same argument has been being made by people who know nothing about this industry, people who have never played a single video game, who never seen a video game, who know nothing about it. And then you have to have journalists go out and talk about this and cover it like it's some serious issue, which that's a whole other issue with Trump, that people have to treat him seriously, which you actually don't have to. He's a fucking idiot. You can be a journalist and tell the actual story, which is that he's a raving lunatic. But, like, how is this? And it's because, you know, there is still this class and this, you know, mindset of people who are willing to just have this conversation about something they know nothing about because they would rather not have the conversation about something they know is meaningful and real.
Yeah.
And it is a significant problem in our political discourse. And it stands in for a lot of bigger things.
Yeah. And it's just, it is this freezing tactic. It is this move to try to appeal to something really basic in people of saying that, like, the problem is something that you can really easily just sort of foist onto this weird external thing. It's like, it's the video games that do this. It's not anything else. It's like, is, you know, like, this, yes, like the Gamergate stuff, like, and like the video, the toxicity of video game subcultures is a really serious conversation to have. But that's, like, you know, the point of it being a subculture is that it is a product of a larger culture, right? And yes. And it's like the root causes of Gamergate and that toxicity and the alt-right and all that stuff does not come from the video games. It comes from the larger culture, and it comes from the ways that, like, those young men felt preyed upon and felt powerless and lashed out at certain things as a result of those feelings that come from all sorts of cultural constructs around toxic masculinity and all that stuff. It's really complicated, but it's like, it's not something that can be boiled down to those video games. And I don't think it's something that is generated from those video games. Like, it is something that there are maybe some games that can contribute to that cultural narrative, but I think that it is ultimately, it's the relationship with, like, people is the stuff that is the most defining thing that pushes people in those kinds of directions. It's not the media that they consume. Like, if they have, like, you know, if they have, like, an abusive father, like, that's the kind of thing that's going to do that. It's not the fact that they play fucking Mortal Kombat, you know? No. Like, that's where it comes from.
And, you know, it goes without saying that this is so far past the actual zeitgeist in video games, you know.
Yeah.
What were the games really tearing up cultural conversations that last year? It was a lot of, like, Nintendo stuff. Breath of the Wild, Super Mario Odyssey are not encouraging anyone to go kill people.
Yeah.
PUBG was out there. But if you know anything about how these things work, PUBG is not... Yes, it's people shooting each other. That is so... If you really took that seriously, if, like, oh, everyone wants to have a battle royale... You would think our culture is much darker than maybe it actually is.
It would have already happened with how popular fucking Hunger Games was.
Right.
You know?
It's like, yeah, if you think PUBG is harmful, then you would also, you know, throw up a flag about Hunger Games being out there and no one's doing that.
Because but then also, like, the other thing that's happened specifically with PUBG is, like, it's been overshadowed by the sort of, like, Battle Royale mode in Fortnite, which is a big cartoonish, ridiculous game, you know?
Yeah, so, like... You know, if you still live in a world where you think Call of Duty is the main thing in video games, that's not the generation we're in.
Yeah.
It just isn't. Like, I get Call of Duty sells fine, but it's not, has no real cultural cachet anymore.
Yeah, it's not Minecraft. It's not like this new Fortnite thing. It's, yeah, it is not like the main thing that breaks out into the big, like, the larger culture.
No, I would not say the stereotype of what a violent video game is the main or most popular, or even close to being the main or most popular genre in modern video games.
Yeah.
So, just kind of obviously, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, but it's like puzzle games on your iPhone, you know?
Right.
Like, it's all of that.
Yeah, it's so stupid. But here's the thing, and here's the thing that angers me most about this. It worked. Donald Trump won. He got it. He got us all talking about this. He got it on the front page of CNN. He got all of the people who salivate over him in the mainstream media to talk about it because, oh, we have to play both sides. We report his side of the story, even though he's a raving lunatic, blah, blah, blah. And he got us talking about it on the podcast. I don't think Donald Trump is a genius, and I don't think he's a savant. I think he's a fucking lemming on the cliff, thinking about jumping over, and we are all running after him and jumping off the cliff with him, and that's what happens every single fucking time. And it's not like he's squashed the gun control debate. The new gun laws just passed in Florida, and that's an amazing thing to see happen.
Yeah.
But he did, for a couple of days, push the other side out of the news a little bit. And it's, you know, I feel like we're reacting to that, but I also feel ambivalent about talking about it at all. But the thing is, people in the media and in this country allow that to happen over and over again. And I am sick of people believing that he has this inherent power over all of us. You don't have to play by those rules. And that's why it pisses me off that the video game people played into it at all. All they had to do was say, no. When the president summons you, you don't have to go talk to him. It's a free country. That is not a... He's not the queen. You do not have to... And also, in England, if the queen called you, you actually wouldn't have to go see her either.
Yeah.
But anyway, you get my point. You don't have to go talk to him. You can say, no, this isn't a conversation. Do your job. And that would be it. And you could shut it down. And no one shuts it down. And we all jump off the cliff with him. And it is one of the most exhausting things about living in the year 2018.
Yep. No, like this tactic typically works, you know, like that Orson Welles interview, I think was like right around the time that the Comics Code Authority thing happened, and like they passed the Comics Code, or they passed, but like, you know, the comics industry self-regulated itself incredibly fiercely to prevent exactly those kinds of controversies. Like, this is the kind of stuff that it typically works. Like, the same thing happened with Hollywood films, you know?
Yeah.
It's just, it's infuriating. It's frustrating. I fucking hate that this keeps on happening. But like, you know, small incremental change in progress can occur. It's just you have to deal with these huge, weird setbacks while it happens.
And look, you know who isn't getting distracted by this? It is the kids who are out there every day marching for this stuff, organizing for this stuff, who have more Twitter followers than the NRA, who are getting shit done out in the world. And they're going to change the world. You know, we both work with high school students and teenagers and in teaching, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I was grading a practice SAT essay from a student the other day. And it was about public health versus individual freedom. And you know what example she wrote about through the whole essay? Gun control.
Yeah.
That is, you can call that freedom, but it's really a public health issue. And I'm like, you know what? The kids are all right. And I went back, I was teaching a class at our alma mater, Golden High School, today. And I went over there, and you know what they had signs up for all over the place? Save net neutrality. A group there was doing a big political action thing about net neutrality. And I'm like, you know what? They've got this.
Yeah.
They've got this. And I do think there will be change on this issue within our lifetimes, because the people who are growing up and who are, you know, we're kind of in that generation, but are younger enough than us to not even have the cynicism of age 25 on them. They're not going to put up with this shit. And that is just a hopeful note to end this conversation on. Because they're not distracted by this.
Yeah.
All right. Let's go ahead and talk about something stupid, Sean.
Shouldn't we?
All right. So, Sean, to end the podcast, today, as we're recording this, not as you're listening to this, so this is a dumb topic to begin with.
It would be a dumb topic regardless of what day it was.
It is. It's March 10th. Nintendo has dubbed March 10th for the last 2 years Mario Day, because M-A-R-1-0 looks like Mario. Kind of like the dumb May the 4th thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, it means basically Best Buy has sales on Mario plushies, I think. But it also means that, hey, I have not done a Mario ranking thing on the podcast yet. I think I did a written top 10 before Odyssey came out, and that was fun. But that was only 10. And there are a lot of Super Mario Bros. Games.
Yes.
So you know what we're going to do, Sean? I'm going to live make myself rank these on the podcast, and it's going to be fun, and the people are going to enjoy it, hopefully. Does that sound good?
I regret this already.
You regret this already. All right. So, Sean, I will turn my computer so you can see the screen with me. All right. I have written down a list of games. We will also, as we go through here, decide if any of these should be stricken from the list. It's anything with the phrase Super Mario in the title, okay? So, mainline Super Mario series.
Right. Have you played all of these games?
Yes.
Okay.
I will admit, some of these I have not ever played to completion. I have played all of these games.
Fair enough.
Okay. Super Mario Bros. 1 for the NES. Super Mario Bros. 2 American. Super Mario Bros. 2 Japanese, which is the Lost Levels. I'll just call it that for the sake of argument.
Okay.
Super Mario Bros. 3. Super Mario Land for Game Boy. Super Mario World for SNES. Super Mario Land 2, 6 gold coins. Here's a interloper. Super Mario World 2 Yoshi's Island.
This is so controversial.
This is hard.
Yeah, my personal belief is that it shouldn't count.
Okay.
I think that you can make the argument either. I will let you decide. I will just say that, that is my personal opinion.
Okay.
I think it is a Yoshi game, not a Mario game.
It's tough because Yoshi's Island, I think in Japan, is just called Yoshi's Island. And then in the Western release, it was called Mario World 2 Yoshi's Island. And of course, there has been a Yoshi series since then that has no relation to Mario World 2. Like, I also do not have on here Super Mario Land 3 Wario Land because I consider that a Wario Land game. So I think I'm going to take Yoshi's Island off by that same token.
Here's my rock hard argument is that it is not a Mario game because you do not play as Mario. And I think to be a Mario game, you have to play as Mario.
You play as Mario a little bit when you get a power up where you play as the baby running around.
That doesn't count.
Doesn't count. Okay.
No.
All right. I agree. Okay. So we're cutting that off. Super Mario 64. Super Mario Sunshine. New Super Mario Bros. Super Mario Galaxy, New Super Mario Bros. Wii, Super Mario Galaxy 2, Super Mario 3D Land, New Super Mario Bros. 2,
Fuck.
New Super Mario Bros. U, Super Mario 3D World, Super Mario Maker, Super Mario Run, we'll get back to both of those, Super Mario Odyssey. Mario Maker and Mario Run. These are tough. I think I'm going to strip Mario Run from the record.
I would say you should strike Mario Maker, but keep Mario Run would be my...
Why?
Because for Super Mario Maker, you spend at least half of the game you do not play as Mario, you play as yourself. So Super Mario Run... Although, I guess, like whether or not you play as Mario in Super Mario Run, it's like it's a slightly more abstracted, but you basically play as Mario. Just Mario has slightly more, you know, free will than he normally has.
So do you think I should keep Mario Run?
I think you should keep Mario Run, and I will leave it up to your decision whether you want to keep Mario Maker.
Here's the thing. Mario Maker is so tough. I feel like if I'm ranking Super Mario Maker, I should have Mario Paint in there or something, like... I know it's very different, and Mario Maker is a Mario game that you play proper Mario levels, but it's also so... I don't know how I would compare it to the others.
Yeah.
So I don't know. This is tough.
Yeah.
This is a tough call. I'm going to leave it.
Okay.
Just for the hell of it.
The one who has to make the list, so I don't give a shit.
Yeah. I'm going to... Unless we get to a point where it's too hard to rank and I'll cut it later... I can call an audible on that, okay?
Okay, fair enough.
Because here's the thing. Mario Run is really easy for me to rank. It's the worst Mario game. So it's going at the bottom.
Okay, yes.
Okay?
I will agree with that. It is the worst Mario game I have played.
Yes. It's not bad for an iPhone game. It's fine. It does nothing special.
Yeah.
I think there were a lot of think pieces when it came out about how this is such a great fucking Mario. No, it's okay. It's a thing. Let's not get our panties in a bunch about it. Yeah. It's not that great. Okay?
It's good for what it could be.
Yes. All right, so next I'm going to make a tier of games I think are in a weaker tier, okay?
Okay, yeah. I know a couple of those that should be there.
One of these is going to be New Super Mario Bros. 2. Now, this is the 3DS one that is not, in fact, the second New Super Mario Bros. Game. So okay. for title fuckery alone, it doesn't get to be there, okay?
Yeah, I have never played any of the New Super Mario Bros. Games, so...
Yes, I just think that one... I like the New Mario Bros. Games in general. That one is really boring. So it's near the bottom... Mario Sunshine is near the bottom.
Where it should be.
Mario Bros. The Lost Levels is near the bottom.
Yep, that's the right choice.
Because it's kind of a messy Mario game. And then I generally like the rest of these a lot, so we will get back to those. But let's rank the bottom tier, okay?
Okay.
So, Sunshine, The Lost Levels, New Super Mario Bros. 2... This is tough.
The Lost Levels is the worst of this game. Like, I haven't played New Super Mario Bros. 2. The Lost Levels is a bad video game.
Yeah.
It's a really, sort of, even-keel, NES platformer. There's nowhere near the elegance of the first Super Mario Bros.
No, and it really does. You play it today, it feels like a weird, ROM hack kind of thing.
Yeah.
Or a series of bad Mario Maker levels. Because it's just Mario Bros. 1 if you've never played it, but with... kind of bad level design. It doesn't have... It's not just hard level design. It's just shitty, unintuitive level design. It's an interesting relic, and I do recommend looking at it for that reason, if you're interested in the history of Mario. But I will agree. I think it is less... Because, I have issues with Sunshine. Sunshine, you can't knock the ambition or anything.
Sure,
And it's contributed... here's the thing. Now getting to New Super Mario Bros. 2 versus Sunshine... I think I would rather pick up and play New Super Mario Bros. 2 because it is a boring game, but it is eminently playable. Super Mario Sunshine, I would not rather pick up and play because I do not find it eminently playable. I think its controls are broken and it is really difficult to play. However, it is a gorgeous game. It has contributed a ton to the aesthetic of Mario and Nintendo in general. Its soundtrack is just a masterpiece. It's got just great atmosphere and a sense of place. It's got its issues. So this is a tough one.
Okay, I will, because I think I have played more Super Mario Sunshine than you have. Granted, that was a long time ago.
Yeah.
But, like, honestly, like yeah, I think the controls are that kind of thing that if you get really good at the game, there's a lot there for you, but it's, like, not particularly accessible. For me, the thing with Super Mario Sunshine is the larger structure of that game is fucking terrible. Yeah. That game has, like, every level has, like, 4 or 5 different 8 red coin challenges. They repeat the same boss fights over and over again. Every single area looks the exact fucking same as every other area. There's, like, a bunch of just bullshit fucking challenges all over the place that are an incredible hassle to play. It's like, the first Mario game that I felt like, oh, the lives thing is a serious restriction in what you can do, and it's, like, lives should not be a thing anymore. Super Mario Sunshine is the game that is the reason why I do not like platformers anymore.
Oh, wow. That is... I understand, though. I have tried Mario Sunshine every couple years. I make a concerted effort to get through that game. And it's everything you're saying. It's just kind of a... And I know there are people who love this game to death.
Then they're wrong.
I respect it. I get it. I kind of get it. Not really. You know, I can't knock the hustle, to quote the poet Jay-Z. But, you know, it is an interesting attempt to do something different with Mario. Yeah. I do think it's kind of a failure of that attempt. I don't find it interesting to play.
It's also, like, the most buggy, rushed Nintendo game I've ever seen. Like, there are clear areas where the content has been cut. Like, you fall through floors sometimes. It's just, it's a rough fucking game.
So I'm putting New Super Mario Bros. 2 above Sunshine.
Good.
And that is going to piss some people off. But hey, that's the point of making lists.
It makes me happy because I don't like Super Mario Sunshine.
Okay. So next, I feel like we should look for the next weakest tier. And let's see what we have here. I am going to put in the next weakest tier, New Super Mario Bros. U. Some weirdo at Polygon said that was the best Mario game ever.
Oh, right. I remember that. I can't remember who it was.
That was the trolliest fucking list. Oh, God. Anyway, I promise no one's trying to troll you with this list. This is an honest effort. Let's see. There are so many good Mario games. This is why I love this series. It is such a dense series. I am making my next list of, like, the ones I would say are weakest after this next one. And honestly, where I went is I grabbed New Super Mario Bros. U and Super Mario Bros. 2.
Super Mario Bros. USA.
USA. Super Mario Bros. 2 / I like Super Mario Bros. USA. It's a great title.
Yeah, that's like, for those who don't know, that is what it was called in Japan. So it's like, it was originally the video game Doki Doki Panic, which is based on like some like weird Fuji TV variety show. That then when it came over here, they took that game and put Mario characters on top of it. And it sold really well over here. And then they took that version with the Mario characters and sold it again in Japan as Super Mario Bros. USA. Which is, like, maybe the smartest thing any video game company has ever done, to take this one video game and by changing the art for only the main characters, because all the monsters and, like, Shy Guys and stuff, Shy Guys are not Mario characters, they are fucking Doki Doki Panic characters. With that one, like, palette swap, they sold that one game 3 fucking times. Once in Japan, once in the US, and then Japan again. Genius.
I don't dislike this game at all. I think it's a very fun little game. I think it's less remarkable than the other Marios. It's very difficult to compare to them because it is so radically different in that it's a platformer, but a very different type of platformer, you know?
Right.
It's very... Mario games in general kind of are slower than like a Sonic or something, but this one is very slow.
You're like stopping every once in a while, like picking up the radishes or whatever and throwing them at enemies.
Yeah, I'm putting it above Mario Bros. U. I think it's a good game.
Yeah, I like it.
I just, I think I'm looking at all these other ones and I simply personally have more fondness for it. So
I do want to just shout out, like even if they were not originally made as Mario characters, there are a lot of great characters like Birdo in Shy Guy.
I love Birdo.
That began with Doki Doki Panic.
Yeah.
Some good music also.
It's a really good game. Yeah. It's a classic for a reason, not just because it's odd. And New Super Mario Bros. U is good. I think it's a good, solid Mario game. I just don't think it's a remarkable Mario game, so that's why it is where it is. It's better than New Super Mario Bros. 2. So it was our first HD Mario. That's kind of neat. And who knows? Maybe one day, I've only played this one on my own. Maybe one day I'll get to do a full like co-op run with my brother and I'll like that game more because that's why I like the Wii one so much, but we'll get to that later.
I will say, as like a blanket statement for like all the New Super Mario games, I think the art style looks bad. And I do not like the way those games look. And that was never more obvious than the Super Mario Maker, where you could quickly switch between Classic Mario and New Super Mario. It's like, this looks bad. They should have either made a 2D or more stylized in 3D.
I'm going to talk about this later. I will stand for the original New Super Mario Bros. Till the end of days. It is an absolute masterpiece platformer. I do think they ran it pretty hard into the ground. And if it were, like, because Mario had never up until, like, well, okay, you have the original, like, Lost Levels, which is a very direct sequel. But
right.
after that, Mario doesn't do the just, we're going to do the same game again thing until New Super Mario Bros. Wii and Mario Bros. 2 and Mario Bros. U. Like, and it's weird. Like, why didn't they change? I feel like for the DS, that was a great art style for that one. But why did it not evolve? That's the weirdest thing to me. On
yeah.
That. Yeah. So, anyway, were you looking something up? Did you want to mention something?
I was just looking at, it's Jeremy Parrish is the guy who did the Super Mario ranking. Like, I really like Jeremy Parrish. I think his Mario ranking is fucking hilarious. You said it was a trolley list. As someone who's read other stuff that dude has written, that is 100% what he truly believes in his heart of hearts.
I did not doubt him
in the slightest.
Okay.
I want to give Jeremy Parrish some credit. I think it's a weird list of Mario games, but he's a weird fucking dude.
I apologize. I did not have that context. Sometimes Polygon publishes some pretty trolly stuff, so I just kind of lumped it in with that. You make a good point. All right. Anyway, let's look at these other ones. I'm going to go the other direction and try to make an upper tier at this point, okay?
Okay.
So I'm going to throw in that upper tier. Odyssey goes up there with the original Mario Bros. The NES one is always up there for me. World is going to be up there.
Yes.
64 is going to be up there.
Yes.
And Galaxy 2 is going to be up there. And, see, this is where it gets tough. I will, looking at everything I have, I will call that the top five. Not in that order. I'm going to order it later.
Okay.
But I will call that the top five.
So you're, so like, Super Mario Brothers 3, I think that's, like, that's one that I think people, I think, like the Super Mario Brothers 3 Super Mario World thing is a hard conversation that a lot of Mario fans have.
I respect Super Mario Bros. 3 more than I love it.
Okay.
It's in the top 10, no doubt for me. I think it's a masterpiece. I think it's influential. I think it's great. It's fun. I find it the least interest, not the least interesting of the original 2D Mario games, because we've already ranked like the 2s lower.
Right.
I do find it less interesting than 1, than World, than, honestly, the New Super Mario Bros. 1 for the DS, personally. I just, because actually New Super Mario Bros. 1 for the DS, I feel like is very influenced by that one and does some of it just a little bit better for me. But like, yeah, I don't know if I can even put my finger on it. I have played Super Mario Bros. 3 several times. Like, I remember being obsessed with the Game Boy Advance re-release when that came out. But I also remember liking some of the other Game Boy Advance ones that came out, like World and Yoshi's Island and the Game Boy Color remake of the NES one. I liked all of those more. So, and I do just think World is a better game in terms of art style and level design and music and all that. I don't know, where do you come down on it?
I think I'm more of a Super Mario World guy.
Yeah.
I know that. I just feel like that's something, I've seen that conversation happen a lot.
I
feel like there are people that are hard 3 people or hard World people.
Oh, there is a strong contingent that will fight you if you try to say anything other than Mario Bros. 3 is the best NES game.
Yeah.
And I think it's an amazing NES game. I honestly do prefer the original NES game. So, like, and I can explain why, and some of it, as with any discussion about Mario, does enter into the realm of nostalgia, because we all have our own individual nostalgias with Mario.
Yes.
And I'll get into that. But yes, those will be my top five eventually. Let's go back to the bottom end of the list and see what we can pull out. I'm going to just start separating these a little bit. I'm going to take New Super Mario Bros. Wii. I'm going to take 3D World, not Land. This is the Wii U one. I'm going to take Mario Land 2, 6 gold coins, and I'm going to delete Mario Maker because I have no fucking idea where I'm ranking.
Okay, we're so already playing that card. You already
I can't do it. I can't do it. This is hard. This is so hard. I should not have done this on the fly. This is stupid.
Yeah. And I think, like, I will stand by that Mario Maker is just too different of a game.
Too different of a game.
It's like putting Little Big Planet in here. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah, it'd be weird. Okay, so I have tiers now of these games, okay?
Yes.
Of the top 13. I have tiers for the top 30. I have a 5, and a 3. In the bottom 3 here, so these are going on the lower end, is New Super Mario Bros. Wii, Super Mario 3D World, and Super Mario Land 2, 6 gold coins. This is tough. 6 gold coins, I know, is a great game. I could never fully get into it, although I really do genuinely enjoy it. I also think that it was the immediate precursor for Wario World, Wario Land. Which I think took a lot of its mechanics and ran with them, and so I just kind of subsumed that into Wario Land did it better in some ways. They're very different games. I don't want to say they're the same thing. So these are tricky ones to parse apart. I think for my own personal nostalgia, and this is only my own rankings,
yes.
I'm putting the Game Boy game, 6 gold coins, at the bottom end of these. I'm going to put... Oh, this is tough between New Super Mario Bros. Wii and Super Mario 3D World. I'm going to leave them like those because I like Mario 3D World. I think it's a really good, strong game. But I think one of its big fun things was the co-op thing. And this was co-op in 3D, which was different. But the co-op experience of New Super Mario Bros. Wii was such a revelation. That game is seriously underrated. It is so good. It's so that was the beginning of Nintendo's new phase of, like, we're going to make our games super fucking challenging again. And if you don't like it, we'll put in, like, a golden bell or something and you can ring it.
Right.
Which was, I think, a nice compromise because ever since, it's allowed them to really experiment with their game design and make it harder. And I've really liked that. So for me, that's the top of those. Mario 3D World also, frankly, this is going to sound stupid, it's overshadowed for me by Captain Toad Treasure Tracker. Like, it had a spinoff that's just better than the original and more interesting. Because everything Mario 3D World does well, other than the sterling, amazing HD visuals, Mario 3D Land on the 3DS, I think, does even better. So,
but Super Mario 3D World is where Cat Mario comes from. That's
Cat Mario is great. I do. That is one of my genuinely my favorite power-ups. It's very good.
I think now is the time I'm going to reveal to you, Jonathan, the reason for which I am subscribed to the Japanese Nintendo YouTube channel, which is something you do not know.
Where is this going?
You do not know that this is a thing. There is a show that comes, I think it's like bi-weekly, that Nintendo produces that goes up on the Japanese Nintendo YouTube channel called Nyan Nyan Neko Mario Time, which translates to Meow Meow Cat Mario Time, which is a show where Cat Mario and Cat Peach, that made their debut in Super Mario 3D World, as puppets, preview, like, Nintendo news and game stuff that is going on in Nintendo, like, fully voice acted with the voices pitched up like they're, like, Alvin and the Chipmunks. And it is maybe the greatest thing that Nintendo has ever done.
That's amazing. And how have I not seen this?
I have no idea how the world has never discovered this. I found it by accident because a Japanese show I really like called Game Center CX does some crossovers that appear on the Japanese Nintendo YouTube channel. That's the only way you can see them. So that's how I started watching videos on that channel and then saw this fucking Cat Mario thing pop up every now and then. And I think that should mean that Super Mario 3D World goes one higher.
I am doing that. Mario 3D World goes one higher. I will still remember the one, like, convention I've ever gone to, which was RTX 2015. I was in line with a couple who were dressed as Cat Mario and Cat Peach, and it was, like, some of the best cosplay I've ever seen. And they were also in Austin in the summer in fucking Cat Mario and Peach costumes. It's amazing the dedication that people have for that.
Yeah.
So it's amazing game and you should play it.
I'm glad that I was able to influence your ranking for two video games I have never touched.
That's great. I also just want to say, though, with my Captain Toad connection, it is fucking amazing to me that Captain Toad got a Wii U port before this one did.
That's maybe says something.
All right. For this next batch, I am putting Super Mario Land, the original Game Boy one, the lowest. I think a lot of people would ask me, like, oh, why do you like Super Mario Land 1 more than 6 gold coins? And part of it is I've just played it more. I played it more when I was a kid. I've played it more as an adult. I also it is one of the most eminently playable Mario games to me because it's short, it's sweet, you pick it up, you play it, it feels super good, it looks so weird and wonderful, because this is the one all done with line art. Mario goes to ancient Egypt, and he goes into space, and there's Galaga-style levels where you're in a spaceship shooting things. It's only 12 levels long, and it is still one of the most aggressively weird fucking Mario games out there. I love Super Mario Land. I think it's a little tiny masterpiece. It is so wonderful. And it scratches a lot of the same itches as the original, like, NES Mario, but not doing the exact same thing the way the Lost Levels did.
Yeah, the Land games just always looked like Nintendo getting to, like, just, like, give Mario to a weird different team that just got to, like, kind of like what Link's Awakening was also. Just, like, they got to just, like, do something crazy with the franchise. And that was always, I respected that.
I respect that, and the music in this one is also some of my favorite 2D Mario music.
That's a good point.
It's so good. All right, our next batch, we have Super Mario Bros. 3, New Super Mario Bros., Super Mario Galaxy, and Super Mario 3D Land.
I know that you really like all of those games.
In my heart of hearts, this is going to sound weird, Mario 3 is my least favorite of those.
Okay.
And you know, it's going to piss people off, it's what these lists are for, but if I'm just being honest with it, I have played this game a lot, I find it really interesting, I do not find it as compelling a piece of game design, aesthetics, music, as any of the other games above it on this list. Still in the top 10 out of like 20-something stupid games ranking for this stupid exercise. But yes, there it is.
Okay.
All right. Then I have Mario 3D Land Galaxy, New Super Mario Bros. Galaxy is the best of those. That's easy. Then you have New Super Mario Bros. And Mario 3D Land. And this one is hard.
Yeah.
Because I think Super Mario 3D Land is an amazing, masterful, kind of slept on game. And
you don't hear people talk about it much.
And it's too bad. And also, like, when people play Odyssey and then are like, this is just like Mario 64. I want to smash their head into a wall because they're ignoring how much of Mario 3D Land and World is in Odyssey. Like, in terms of gameplay, way more than 64. Like, I think it's some of the best pure platforming in any 3D Mario game. Like, it is. And also what it does for 3D space. It's the, like, I haven't played VR. I guarantee you there's no VR game that uses space the way this game has in terms of actual gameplay mechanics in 3D. It's an amazing, amazing thing. And was kind of this golden shining moment where the 3DS actually used that, not just for nice visuals, because there's plenty of 3DS games that have used it as more than a gimmick for true aesthetic enhancement, but for something where this game would be hard to play with the 3D off. It really uses it. It is this own weird little, like, interactive treatise on space and physicality and physics in platformers. It's an amazing game. New Super Mario Bros. Is one of those games I've probably beat, like, 15 times.
Okay.
I have played it so many times. I played the shit out of it on the DS. People forget this is easily the highest-selling Mario game of all time.
Right,
It sold, like, 60 million copies on the Nintendo DS. Every single person on the planet, you know, played this not every, obviously, but, like, everybody played this game. It's so great. I have nostalgia for it also because my dad grew obsessed with this game, and it was like the one game he had on DS and would play it all the time, including the Luigi Solitaire mode where Luigi will deal and play you solitaire. He loved playing that. It's so charming. I think the level design is so good. It's one that I think because of all the sequels people look down on the DS original, go back and give it a try. It is a better game than you remember. It is pound for pound, level for level, move for move, a crazy solid Mario game. I think it's missing some of the higher-end challenge that some of the later ones have, but I think as a revival for this kind of Mario side-scroller, it really felt innovative at the time. It wasn't just repeating what World or 3 or 2 or 1 did. It was a proper Mario 5, and you know, then we had Mario 5.1, 5.2, 5.3, you know,
right.
and Mario Run is another one of those, right?
Yeah.
And that's a little disappointing, but the original one is too good to sleep on, so I'm putting it at the top of this choice, even though I think those are both amazing handheld Mario games.
Okay.
All right.
Interesting choice.
Mario Galaxy is one of the best games ever made, and it finishes just outside the top five, because it has a sequel that is just slightly better than it, and
okay.
that is Galaxy 2. I have talked at length about Galaxy. It is one of the best games ever made. But so are Galaxy 2, Mario 64, Mario World, Mario Odyssey, and the original Mario Bros. And now I have to decide between these games.
Yeah. This will be exciting.
This is really hard, Sean.
You're the one that chose to do this.
This is really, really hard. I don't know what to do.
Okay. I like Super Mario 64 and the original Super Mario Bros. More than Super Mario World.
I do too. I also, frankly, like Galaxy 2 and Odyssey more than Mario World.
I haven't played those two, but
I am going to put Mario World at the bottom of these.
Oh, man. Oh, yes.
May God have mercy on my soul.
I will go with you on this. Like, I don't like Super Mario World as much as most. I think it's a fucking great video game.
Yeah, it's great.
But like, there is something about, like, the original Super Mario Brothers that has this charm and immediacy and straightforwardness that I really admire.
Super. Well, let's talk about that. Because Mario Bros. 1 could be my number 1, could be my number 2, up to 4 here. This is my favorite side-scrolling Mario game. It always has been. It always will be. I have particular nostalgia for this where it just, the cycle came around where even though I was not alive when this game came out on NES, I was alive when I bought the Game Boy Color as my first ever gaming system. The first games I played were on Game Boy Color. And one of the first games I got for it was Super Mario Bros. Deluxe, the remake for the Game Boy Color of the original NES Mario Bros. And therefore, I'm kind of in the same boat as people who like got an NES when they were kids, and Super Mario Bros. Was their entry point to games where this game that was the birth of this whole era of video games we live in, right? It was also the birth of my love of video games. And I love the original Super Mario Brothers to no end. I as you say, the simplicity and directness of it, the just there are no frills on that game. It's just you, a jump button, and an ability to awkwardly run and not stop when you really want to. And I love it. And I have played this game to completion many, 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 many times in my life on many different remakes. The original NES, the Color version, the All-Stars version for Super NES, the All-Stars version for Wii, which is just the Super NES one on a disc. You know, I think this is still, all these years later, about as good as that kind of thing gets. There's just something about it that is perfection. And some of that is just the level design is both that good and that also unrefined because there were no rules, and there's something about that that's just so intoxicating to this day, and so yeah. I love that game.
I think it also just has like this indelible charm to it that is distinct to me from most other Mario games in such a way that I don't even like the Super Mario All-Stars version of it because I want the original graphics. Like, I do not like it being prettied up in like the Super Nintendo fashion. Like, I want like the weird, like, brownish Mario that like doesn't even look like Mario anymore and like Princess Toad, like just all that weird shit. There's something about that original Super Mario Brothers, which is a game that I didn't grow up with, like that I didn't have that like Game Boy version of it either. Like, I came back to it like in high school or something. It was just like, I should probably play Mario games at some point, and went back and played the Super Mario Brothers 1, sort of USA 3 in world, and 1 is the one that like every once in a while I'll load that up on like an emulator or something, just on like a whim, and just like, I just want to play some of this game, which is a thing I don't do with any other Mario game.
Yeah, it's worth it. All right, I've stalled for long enough.
Yeah.
I have to choose between the 3D games. I think if you came back to me in a couple of years on this, I might say Mario Odyssey is the best Mario game. But I need to replay it. I need to sit with it. I need to think about it. And so for now, I'm going to put Mario Odyssey at number 4, below 64 and Galaxy 2. Because I have played Galaxy 2 twice. I think it is a utter masterclass of platforming and level design, and I think Mario Odyssey maybe is an even better, pure overall blend of that, but I also think the Galaxy games did something just so utterly special that I am still 10 years later like reckoning with personally, and Odyssey just hasn't entered that space for me yet, but it is a great game.
Okay.
So I'm going to have Odyssey there. Then I have to choose between Galaxy 2 and 64. Now, here's the way I did this in the past in my top 10. I had Mario 64 at 1, the NES game at 2, and Galaxy 2 at 3.
Okay.
But I feel like it would be boring to do the same thing again.
Okay, because that is, as someone who has never played Super Mario Galaxy 2, that is how I would rank those games.
Okay. Well, then, I don't really know what that's worth, but yes.
Super Mario 64 is my favorite one, like, partially for the nostalgia stuff. Also for, like, I love that sense of exploration.
It's a weird thing where I always say that as much as I love Mario 64, you know, I'm also someone who's really into the linear design Mario games. I love the platforming challenges. I love all these things that Mario 64 actually doesn't really do.
Yeah.
And yet I consistently call it my favorite Mario game, and it is, but it's so separate from the series in weird ways to me. So this is tough, and I do kind of, at one point I want to do one of these rankings where I plant some other flag in there. And that's why one day, and maybe I should just be bold and do it now, I might say Odyssey is the best, because Odyssey mixes every element of Mario I love under one roof. It has the 64 free open exploration. It has the 2D level design sometimes of the original Super Mario Bros. With that exact art style in fun, fresh, new HD. It's got the crazy platforming 3D challenges of Galaxy and Galaxy 2, and the tight controls and weird ideas of the 3D Land and World series. It has the zany streak of Mario Land, and it has the overall inventiveness that this series is known for. It is in many ways the ultimate Mario game, and when I talk myself into it, I'm just going to put it at number 1.
But does it in that lose a focus? Does it lose a sense of like direct identity of its own uniqueness, or does it lose itself in the Ur Mario, or does it not plant its own flag as its own thing?
I do believe it plants its own flag as its own thing. You know, this was a significant challenge for me last year when we did our top 10, and I had this at 3, Persona 5 at 2, and Zelda at 1, because I said it then, and I'm dead serious. Those are 3 of my favorite games ever made. And ranking those, you know, on a hairpin like that was very, very tough. Because I think Mario Odyssey very much could go for that. And I think maybe just to be different, I kind of want to plant my flag with that.
Okay.
Because there is no Mario... Because when I feel this conflict of like, I want to call the NES original my favorite, but then I'm losing this thing I love from Mario 64. But Mario 64 has not taken the series in those insane 3D directions that you get by the time of Galaxy 2. But then I look at Odyssey and it's like, I do think it's a cohesive whole. I do think it's just about as good as this kind of thing can be. It's so just fluid and perfect and amazing. I think I'm going to go ahead, and because this means nothing.
Yeah, this no. Is, it means less than nothing.
This is because on a whim earlier today, I realized it was Mario Day, and that gave me a podcast topic. And now I realize we're 2 hours, 40 minutes. We didn't need the extra topic.
Yeah.
So here's what we're doing. I'm putting it at number one. I am putting NES at number two.
Oh,
64 at
three. I can't agree with this.
Oh, so, let me think about it.
May I remind you, Super Mario 64 has that song that plays in the level with the pirate ship?
Okay. That 60, really 64, 64 is number two. Okay.
There we go.
So I've got them all ranked. Let me throw them into a numbering thing on Microsoft Word. All right, this was 19 games from 19 to 1. 19, Super Mario Run. 18, Super Mario Bros. The Lost Levels. 17, Super Mario Sunshine. 16, New Super Mario Bros. 2. 15, New Super Mario Bros. U. 14, Super Mario Bros. 2 / Super Mario Bros. USA. 13, Super Mario Land 2, 6 gold coins. 12, New Super Mario Bros. Wii. 11, Super Mario 3D World. 10, Super Mario Land. 9, Super Mario Bros. 3. 8, Super Mario 3D Land. 7, New Super Mario Bros. 6, Super Mario Galaxy. 5, Super Mario World. 4, Super Mario Galaxy 2. 3, Super Mario Bros. For the NES. 2, Super Mario 64, and 1, Super Mario Odyssey, because fuck it.
Okay, as someone who has at least touched probably about a third to a half of the games on this list, I feel pretty good about that ranking.
It's fairly similar to what I did on my top 10 the other year.
Yeah.
I did this, but oh well. Not everyone reads and listens to the podcast, so that's why true. We do these little things once in a while.
I'm very happy that Super Mario 64 and Super Mario Brothers are higher than Super Mario World. I'm very happy that Super Mario Sunshine is near the bottom of that list. So all of my, and I liked that game I didn't play got placed above another game I didn't play because I revealed the secret hidden knowledge that the world should know that Nintendo constantly is putting on a fucking puppet show with Cat Mario and Cat Peach on their Japanese Nintendo channel, and fucking the English speaking world has never known this. It's a secret that Japanese Nintendo is way more interesting than American Nintendo.
You shook it loose for me. You shook something about the game loose for me, and it helped. So there's my silly rankings. Happy Mario Day, everyone, even though by the time you listen to this, it is no longer Mario Day.
Yeah, so again, that whole list is worth less than nothing.
We said we were going to talk about Annihilation. We will. We're going to record that now.
Yeah.
I'm going to hold it, possibly for a rainy day, but you'll hear it eventually.
Sure.
On the Weekly Stuff podcast. Yay.
Cat Mario Puppet. It's just amazing.